It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Friday? Yeah, I'm ready to. Is it the weekend yet? Joe Thornton is throat-punching goalies. I think we must need a couple of days off if Joe Thornton is throat-punching goalies. I'm Scott Rintoul. Thanks for joining us this morning. You've got the text line. You've got the fan feedback line. And we want you in on the conversation. We got a loaded up show this morning. We're going to bounce around a couple of different places, and it'll all make sense as we go along here. But we got Jacob Pelche coming up at the bottom of the hour. Flames first rounder. He's going to be a part of Canada's selection camp beginning next week. Likely a part of Canada's team at the World Juniors this year. We'll talk to him. We're going to check in on the Minnesota Wild. And if you haven't checked in on the Minnesota Wild lately, you'll find out why we're going to have that conversation here in the next little bit. Eric Francis, Ian McIntyre, we're going to have a conference call. Second hour, we're going to bring them both in the same segment, get their views on the Pacific Division, what's going on right now with the respective teams on either side of the Rockies, and just try to handicap where this race is at. It's one that looks like it's going to be muddy for quite some time. Arizona is your new division leader in the Pacific. The Arizona Coyotes, we're talking about hockey, the Pacific Division in the NHL. Yeah, the Arizona Coyotes, who were right in it up until almost the end last year, and they added Phil Kessel, and guess what? They're leading the division right now. Is that enough to go get Taylor Hall? Is that then enough to convince him to stay? I don't know, but it's a really good story last year, and it's been a good story again this season. And they have overtaken the Edmonton Oilers. For the time being, both teams in action tonight. There's four Pacific Division teams in action tonight. They all picked up points last night, the ones that were playing. Some got 1 point, some got two. But as you wake up today, 6 points separate first from sixth in the Pacific Division. And it's been very much the same story for the Coyotes. I don't think that comes as any surprise. They didn't change their identity overnight. Phil Kessel did not make them into last year's Tampa Bay Lightning. In fact, Phil Kessel hasn't really done that much. He got a couple of goals last night. Good news for him. Good news for the Coyotes. But the identity this year, very similar to the identity you saw last season. Nobody with more than 20 points. Nobody. Top guy, 20 points. But there are 11 players with 10 points or more. Same deal with goals. There's only one guy in double digits. Remember last year we had the conversation down the stretch about the Coyotes? Are they going to make the playoffs without a 20-goal scorer? No team had done that. They didn't quite get in, but they almost did. Well, it's kind of the same deal this year. There's only one guy in double digits. Connor Garland has 11 goals, but they've got 10 guys with five or more. You want to talk about depth scoring? You want to talk about rolling lines and everybody chips in? That's your Arizona Coyotes, folks. And right now, it has them 38 points on top of the Pacific Division. How come? Fewest goals allowed in the Western Conference. Comes back to that. You saw what it did for the Islanders last year. You saw what it did for Dallas last year. And now you're seeing what it does for the Arizona Coyotes. Darcy Kemper has been sensational. And that story continues to be a good one. The Flames, big win last night. That's a big win, a much-needed win. Funny how things happen, and I don't think the situation involving Bill Peters is funny whatsoever, but funny strange is more what I'm talking about, as opposed to funny ha-ha. The Flames, under Bill Peters, after last year's record-breaking season, 108 points, couldn't string together three wins. This whole incident comes to light. Bill Peters is removed from the team. Jeff Ward has not lost a game as a head coach in the National Hockey League. He's 3-0. Their first three-game winning streak of this season comes after the spectacle of Bill Peters and Jeff Ward being installed as the interim head coach. Much-needed win, and more importantly for the Flames, sometimes it's not about style points. It kind of was last night. They held on at the end. They're not going to be real happy with the final 5 minutes of the third period. However, they got four goals, and the four goals they got were from the four guys you would nominate, the four guys you would ask for. Well, you can score four goals tonight. Who do you want them to be? You know what? I'd put these four guys there. Please give me a goal from each of these guys. That's exactly what they got. The Saddledome slump buster is basically what it was. Johnny Gaudreau had been 10 games without. He scores the opener, despite only playing just over 13 minutes and playing with Derek Ryan and Milan Lucic, and I know that's not the trio that scored. He gets the power play goal. Johnny Hockey, he gets one. He needed one. He busts a slump. Milan Lucic, there was no slump longer than this one, had not scored as a Calgary Flame. Finally scored last night, kind of laughed about it because it hit a stick, and it wasn't exactly for sure when it came off the blade of his twig. But there's Milan Lucic getting his first goal. Tobias Reeder went 0 for November. He scores last night, and he scores shorthanded last night. And Sean Monahan, who hasn't been in as much of a slump lately, and it hasn't been that long since his last goal, but it hasn't exactly been the typical Sean Monahan start to the season. So the Flames pick up a couple of points. They beat the Buffalo Sabres last night. Riddick, excellent once again. And the four guys who needed to get goals, they all got goals. So the Flames pick up a couple. The Coyotes pick up a couple. There's Vegas picking up a point. There's the San Jose Sharks picking up a point. As mentioned, Pacific Division's pretty tight. First to sixth, 6 points separate that span. So I will ask you this. I want your feedback on it, and you can tell me why, and please sign your text. Which Pacific Division team do you have the most confidence in right now? Maybe not the one you like the most. Maybe not the one you cheer for the most. Hey, they might be the exact same team. But when you look at the way the first third of this season has gone down, which team do you have the most confidence in? Is it a team that hasn't gotten it going yet, but you like the parts? Is it the Arizona Coyotes? Because the one thing you know about them, they're consistent. Edmonton, have you just seen enough from Draisaitl and McDavid that you're willing to go in and say, I don't care if it doesn't look sustainable, they'll find a way with those two guys leading the charge and they're getting enough saves. Vancouver, people have liked the process so far. Is that enough? San Jose is the pedigree. Go down the list. You tell me which team do you have the most confidence in right now in the Pacific Division? Because if all of this continues, it's going to take around 91 points, 90, 91 points to get into the playoffs. Kind of like last year. I was among those who said, man, Colorado getting in the last wildcard spot with 90 points, you're not going to see that again. You're going to need a lot more than that. Well, based on the current point projections, based on the teams hovering around the wild card, it's only going to take about that again. It's going to be pretty similar. And what that means is you're going to need to be, if you're in that team right now, in that mix right now, if you are Vancouver, if you are Calgary, if you are Minnesota, yeah, that's right. The Minnesota Wild currently have the second wild card spot. Somebody forgot to tell the Wild they're bad. That's what it feels like. What do you mean the Wild are sitting there right now with the second wild card spot? Well, the hottest team in hockey. Nobody pays attention to them. Nobody's noticed this other than those who cover the team. And we're going to talk to Sarah McClellan later this hour. They're 8-0-3. Hottest team in hockey right now. So if you're Minnesota, if you're Calgary, if you're Vancouver, if you're San Jose, if you're hovering right around that spot, here's what the math tells you right now. At minimum, you're going to have to be 6 to 9 games over 500 the rest of the way if you want in. Is that achievable for the team that you follow? 6 to 9 games. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's about where the math tells you you're going to be. So which Pacific Division team do you have the most confidence in right now? Hit me up. You've got the text line. You've got the fan feedback number. We will get those on the show, and we'll talk about it throughout the course of the morning. How about those Cowboys? How about them Cowboys? Did you watch that game last night? I know a lot of people were paying attention. It was a busy night in hockey, but you're flipping over to the Thursday nighter. How about those Dallas Cowboys? What's the excuse this time, guys? What's the excuse this time? That's what I'd like to know. Dak was there. Zeke was there. Amari Cooper was there. Gallup, Witten, they were all there. And they're playing the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, it's hard to just roll into Chicago and slow down Mitch Trubisky, though. Come on.
I asked you yesterday. I asked you what you want out of the Thursday nighter if you don't have a rooting interest, and I told you what you should want is chaos theory. You got chaos theory last night. It's the Dallas Cowboys losing. It's Mitch Trubisky having a great game, which he did. And now in Chicago, you've got Bears fans wondering, oh, were we too hard on this guy? Might he be the guy we go with next year? And now in Dallas, you're saying, how can this be possible? How can we be leading the division at 6-7? That division is pathetic. It really is. It is a pathetic division, the NFC East. 6-7 right now gets you top spot. Washington is 3-9, and Washington, in theory, could win the division still. Imagine that. You're 3-9, and you say, you know what? If we run the table here, we win these next four games, we're in. We've fired our coach and quarterback during the course of this season, and we could still get into the postseason.
Imagine Washington hosting a playoff game. Like, absurd.
Yes, it
is. Just totally absurd.
Well, one of these teams is going to get to host, which is absurd to begin with. Cowboys, Eagles, likely one of those two teams, and neither deserves it, but that's the way the playoff format works. That is one of the most embarrassing displays of tackling I have seen in quite some time. One of the worst I can remember witnessing. It's like the Cowboys defense was playing flag football last night against Mitch Trubisky and the Chicago Bears. Troy Aikman, he went in after the game on the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, I don't know how you come back from this. I really don't, Joe. I mean, for the last 2 weeks, we've heard from them that they were going to get it going. They had a chance at home against the Buffalo Bills to finally beat a team with a winning record. That didn't happen. They got embarrassed in that game. They come here against a team that had a lot to prove but was struggling in a lot of areas, and it was the same old story. And so, yes, even though we knew before this game kicked off that it didn't matter if they lost, they were still going to be in contention, I don't know how you sell that if you're Jason Garrett or Jerry Jones or anyone when you have a performance like that to say, hey, but we're still alive. I mean, hey, we'll go play this week against the Rams, and it's all right out in front of us, and I don't think the players hear that. I wouldn't hear it if I were them, and this is on the players as much as it is on the coaches. They've got to be better, but I'm not sure I'd even talk to the team this week. I'd just say, let's just go play next week, and you guys figure it out. But the talk is over, and it has been over for a while.
That would be incredible if we had that audio of Jason Garrett saying, I'm not even going to talk to you guys this week. You figure it out. Let's just go play. That would be incredible. But I have something more incredible for you. We have the ultimate plot twist. You heard Troy Aikman say, if I'm Jason Garrett, if I'm Jerry Jones, if I'm anyone, I'm not sure how I get this turned around. We've got the anyone for you. We've got the ultimate plot twist. We will reveal that later on in the show. But the Thursday Nighter leads us into week 14 of the National Football League. Let's get you set for the weekend with the six pack.
I feel the need for speed.
Ow! Yeah, a couple of top guns who love to run. They hook up in Buffalo as the Blackbirds battle the Bills. Lamar Jackson, he's just four games away from winning the league MVP. He has the Ravens in control of the number one seed in the AFC. Eight straight wins, the NFL's top ground game, and a much improved defense makes the Ravens the favorite no matter where they play these days. But Baltimore was held in check offensively by the 49ers last Sunday, especially in the second half. And Buffalo boasts the league's third-best defense. The Bills aren't great against the run, but they don't allow many points, which is, in fact, the point of the exercise. And when they're exercising their offense, the guy in command, much like Jackson, is a second-year pivot who likes to stretch his legs.
First snap inside the 20. Allen, open field, inside the 10. And he goes all the way for the touchdown.
Josh Allen has less than half of Lamar Jackson's rushing yards, but he's actually scored one more touchdown than his fellow 2018 draft pick. He hasn't been nearly as productive through the air, but Allen has made one massive improvement in the turnover department. He's thrown just one interception in his last seven games. He's also seen an uptick in production from rookie running back Devin Singletary, who's averaging over 5.5 yards a carry this season. Throw in receiver John Brown, who's having a career year, and the Bills they actually have enough talent to at least give the Ravens a run, if not pull the upset in Orchard Park.
Justin Tucker for the winner from 49 yards. Snap is good. Kick on the way. It is long enough. And the kick is good. The time has come off the clock. The Hayes in the barn. And the Ravens take down the 49ers.
Two losses by a grand total of 6 points this season, and the 49ers suddenly find themselves seated fifth in the NFC. Now, that ranking won't change without a little help this weekend, but San Fran needs to help itself by beating a top-tier team in New Orleans. The 10-2 Saints have the same record as the Niners, but they've already locked up a playoff berth thanks to an inferior division. The Houdats, they haven't earned a lot of style points along the way, but they certainly present problems, even for one of the NFL's best defenses. Drew Brees, he has the league's number one receiver at his disposal, while the 49ers have the league's best pass defense. But they haven't seen anything like this. Nothing close to the caliber of Michael Thomas since week one. Tight end Jared Cook, he's also starting to heat up, and Alvin Kamara, he's due for a big game. But the Saints' D is too often overlooked, and that could cause problems for Jimmy Garoppolo.
Here comes the pressure again. Ryan!
No chance.
The game shut down by Cameron Jordan, who's had a standout performance, a four-sack Thanksgiving night.
Cam Jordan now second in sacks among NFL pass rushers, and as you just heard, coming off a four-sack performance against the Falcons. Garoppolo hasn't dealt particularly well with pressure this season. Instead, he's been using play action to pump up his passing. That, of course, hinges on San Fran's rip-roaring run game, which should get Matt Breida back on Sunday. The Saints have brought the pound to the ground. They do rank third in run D entering the stretch drive. Nothing will come easy in the Big Easy, so buckle up. Get ready for some pad popping this weekend.
Look at Marlon Mack go up the sideline. 15, 10, 5, touchdown.
Been a while since the Colts fans have heard that name breaking the plane, but Marlon Mack is set to return after missing two straight weeks with a fractured hand. Indy was on the wrong side of the scoreboard in each of those games, and it leaves the Colts in desperation mode down the stretch. With virtually no chance of overtaking the Texans for the division title, Indy must set its sights on one wild card spot. That's the one that's up for grabs. They'll need to win at least three of their final four to have a shot at earning a wild card. So who better to start the stretch drive with than against the league's biggest wild card?
Second down and six, and Winston, and he drills it downfield, and it is...
Was that a touchdown? Was it an interception? I don't know. You've got a 50% chance of being right when it comes to Jameis Winston. He's thrown as many TDs as Aaron Rodgers this season, but he also leads the league in interceptions. Bucks bench boss Bruce Arians, non-committal on Winston's future in Tampa Bay when asked this week, so Jameis has a month to sway the vote. At 5-7, Tampa is in the familiar position of not playing for much beyond job stats and those fantasy football players relying on a big week from Chris Godwin and or Mike Evans. If consistency matters, the Colts get the job done. But if the best of Tampa Bay comes to play, the Bucs just might earn you a few bucks if you're a fan of risky business.
The New England Patriots are known to like kind of game plan the opponent really well, so I feel like every time you play them, you can expect a few wrinkles.
That's Chief Offensive Lineman Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He's a friend of the show, which he actually takes more pride in than both his status as a pro athlete and a medical doctor. And in his fine medical opinion, the Chiefs are prepared for the Patriots. New England outlasted KC in overtime in the AFC Championship game last year, but Tom Brady's bunch looks nothing like the crew that put up 37 points in that Kansas City shootout. In fact, the Pats have not crossed the 30-point plateau in close to 2 months, which is remarkable when you consider they're 10-2. The ground game still has ground to a relative halt, and Tom Brady still searching for receivers he can count on beyond Julian Edelman. Meanwhile, the Chiefs have last year's MVP back behind center, and they're starting to look like themselves again.
Mahomes to the end zone. Did he get it in? Yes! Kelce, touchdown!
Patrick Mahomes still top 10 in touchdown passes despite missing 2.5 games with a dislocated kneecap. Only Aaron Rodgers has a better TD to INT ratio than Mahomes this season, and he'll need to be precise against the Pats. New England has picked off a league-leading 20 passes this season, but they didn't snag any off Deshaun Watson last weekend. However, there's no place like home for the Pats, who are 61-14 in their own stadium in December with Brady at quarterback. If you're a believer in history, take the Patriots. Unless you believe in recent history, which favors the Chiefs. I can't see the future, but at present, I'm not looking past the Chiefs.
It's blocked! It's blocked, and it's picked up on the play by Ty Smith. After getting blocked on the play by Crookshank, he'll take it the distance, and that is a score!
In true Titans fashion, they beat the Colts in the most unpredictable way possible. That's just what they do. That blocked field goal vaulted Tennessee to 7-5 of the season and into a tie with Pittsburgh for the final playoff spot in the AFC. The Ryan Tannehill rebirth tour, it continues to defy all expectation. As the former Dolphins pivot, he's now 5-1 since taking the reins in Nashville. Also surging up the standings, running back Derrick Henry. He's up to just 35 yards behind the league in rushing. He's racked up 496 yards over the past 3 weeks. Despite all of this, it's still tough to buy the Titans as a legit playoff team when you consider who else is in the running.
And here we go, the defense with the steal and the run back. It's Thornhill, the rookie, for his first NFL touchdown on the pick six.
That clip is meant to highlight a ragtag Raiders team that sits just a game behind the Titans in the playoff chase, despite being outscored, wait for it, 74-12 over its past two games. When everything comes together for this 6-6 squad, they can run the ball with Josh Jacobs, set up play action for Derek Carr, and actually score a few points. But no matter which offense shows up, the defense is guaranteed to disappoint. Only four teams have given up more points than the Raiders, who generally allow the bulk of those through the air. But this game is in Oakland, where the Raiders have won four or five games they played in the Coliseum. It's tough to sell the Raiders as a good bet to win, but it's tough to sell this game as a legitimate playoff battle for a playoff spot. Help me out a little here, folks.
Third down and five. Wilson's going to go deep, wide open, and into the hands of David Moore.
That dime helped Russell Wilson become the king of Monday night, improving his all-time record to an NFL best 9-2. Another primetime tilt awaits Wilson in L.A. as the division-leading Seahawks lock horns with the Rams. Seattle flies south, having won five straight, now in complete control of a first-round bye in the NFC playoffs. The Hawks' margin for error, it's been slim all season, but Seattle has defied the odds, posting a 9-1 record in games decided by one score.
Close games are cool, aren't they?
Yeah, Pete Carroll only knows one way. But you can't argue with the record, especially when it comes to road games. Seattle's a perfect 6-0 in visiting stadiums, but will be facing a desperate and familiar foe. At 7-5, the Rams sit one game back in the wildcard chase, and they're coming off their most impressive win in nearly 3 months and likely haven't forgotten this.
Zerline missed it. Good snap, good hold. He just pushes it right ever so closely and just misses it.
That's not the only thing that's been missing in L.A. this season. Todd Gurley's struggles, well chronicled, as have those of Jared Goff been. Goff has thrown exactly 100 more passes than Wilson this season, but Seattle's slinger has twice as many touchdown passes and a third of the interceptions. That all said, this game likely comes down to how Seattle handles Aaron Donald and the rest of the Rams rushers under the L.A. lights on Sunday night. As a quick trip through the six-pack for the weekend, Jacob Pelche looking to make Canada's World Junior team. He joins us next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
And with our first selection from Moncton of the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, Jacob Pelche.
Okay, Brian, you're right. You're not shy.
That was Brad Treliving announcing the Flames' first selection in Vancouver this past June. It was Jacob Pelche who's set to join us here momentarily. He is among those 31 players who got the call. Go to selection camp next week, hoping to be part of the World Junior team. Jacob Pelche has a very good shot to do that. Hoping to speak with him in just a couple of minutes. The forward with the Moncton Wildcats, going to play a couple of games. Then he's off to selection camp next week with Team Canada. Keep those texts coming in. We asked you at the outset of the show, and we'll continue to discuss this as the show rolls on. Which team do you have the most confidence in right now in the Pacific Division? Arizona leads it. You fall all the way down to sixth place and you find Calgary. But Calgary's got the same number of points as the guys who are in fifth and the guys who are in fourth. Tight, tight confines right now. I put this out last night as well. The most common answer is still Vegas. I wonder how much of that is confirmation bias. I wonder how much of that is just a realization that that roster looks better constructed than the others in the Pacific Division. And when I say confirmation bias, what's the one team out of the Pacific Division you would have said, they're in the playoffs, they win it, we all had Vegas. I had Vegas, you had Vegas, we all had Vegas at the top of this division. They're not there right now, but you see the potential. And you probably remember what happened with St. Louis last year and that the first half doesn't completely bury you and it's not as though Vegas has put itself in that position. They're sitting there third in the division right now, 35 points. A little bit up on Minnesota, a little bit up on Vancouver, San Jose, and Calgary. Minnesota, by the way, we're going to talk our Wild hockey in just a few minutes' time. Minnesota's got a wild card spot as of today. That wasn't supposed to happen. They were supposed to be battling the Kings for the basement of the Western Conference. But back to the Pacific Division. Vancouver, San Jose, Calgary, all with 32 points. The Canucks have played one less game than both the Sharks and the Calgary Flames. But that's just outside the playoffs right now. It's tied for that final wild card spot. Yet you're only 6 points away from the top of the division. So it depends on whether you're a pessimist or an optimist, or maybe if you're a realist. What do you see? Keep those texts coming in. We're getting a bunch of them. Jake in Langley says, Vegas is the team he has the most confident in, and I don't like Vegas, says Jake. Dom from Calgary says, Arizona is a sleeper to win the Pacific. I think Edmonton will fall off to a wild card team and battle it out with Vancouver. Calgary should be somewhere in between. That's from Dom in Calgary. Flames need to get it going. They've got their first three-game winning streak, I should say, on the board right now. Odd that it would take, and I'm not suggesting it's just a result of this, but the dismissal of Bill Peters. It coincides with Jeff Ward taking over behind the bench. Hasn't lost a game yet as the head coach. Next up, the LA Kings, who are in Edmonton tonight. So the Flames in good position to extend that streak to four games. We get the latest round, perhaps, of Doughty Tkachuk tomorrow night. Everybody will be tuning in to see how that goes. But the Kings play tonight in Edmonton. Then they've got to travel to Calgary. And so the Flames get, theoretically, a tired hockey team on Saturday night. Sabres went in there last night. Flames took care of business. 55 minutes, it all was coming together. Had to hang on a little bit at the end. Next up for the Sabres, the Vancouver Canucks. That's an afternoon game for those of you who haven't been paying attention. That one's going to go at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 2 o'clock Mountain time, if you want to tune into the Canucks and Sabres. The odd 1 o'clock Saturday game. We're conditioned to our two time slots on that day. We're not going to get it in Vancouver. It's an afternoon affair tomorrow. The Minnesota Wild. We're going to talk to Sarah McClellan in just a couple minutes' time. Jacob Peltier, I don't know if he went long at practice. I'm not sure what the deal is. We'll see if we can get him on the show here momentarily. We're going to talk to Sarah McClellan of the Minnesota Star Tribune. This team, as I said, was supposed to be dead and buried. They started poorly. Bill Guerin got brought in. He had to wait and see. Everybody figured Bruce Boudreau was only a matter of time because this Wild team just isn't good enough. We saw where they finished last year. They're old. But for whatever reason, they haven't packed it in. And you would think this had all been done on the back of Devan Dubnyk if Minnesota was going to go on an 8-0-3 tear. Right? It's got to be Dubnyk. That guy gets going. Hey, you get great goaltending. I don't care which team you are. You can beat anybody in this league. Hasn't been the case. Last night, again, Alex Stalock. They've been doing this without Devan Dubnyk. Anybody, any guesses who the leading scorer on the Minnesota Wild is? Jason Zucker. Probably not the first name that would have come to mind. You probably would have guessed Parise. Maybe you'd guess Matt Zuccarello. Oh, yeah, they added him, too. They added another guy who we all like, but is on the other side of 30. And that's kind of what the Minnesota Wild have been. Jason Zucker only has 21 points, but that's good enough to lead the Wild. Eric Staal. Oh, yeah, he's still going, too, is he? He's got 20 points. And the Wild have somehow become the NHL's hottest team and somehow climbed into a wild card spot in the West. I don't know how long it lasts. Certainly that type of run is unsustainable. But all of a sudden, they played themselves back into the conversation. And that is the bigger conversation about the Western Conference right now. This glut of teams. All of them in the murky middle. It's been really tough for any of these teams to distance themselves from the pack. St. Louis is really the only one that's done it. And here's what makes this so much more difficult to handicap. Okay, St. Louis, Colorado, we buy that. We're not sure about Winnipeg. They're outscoring their problems on the back end, and Hellebuck's been sensational, but can they keep that up? I don't know. We'll wait and see. They're ahead of projection. What makes this so much more difficult is that San Jose, Calgary, and Nashville are hovering below the playoff bar right now. Vancouver is technically, because they lose the tiebreaker with the Minnesota Wild, but Vancouver's kind of been in that spot all season long. Third in the Pacific, wild card spot. They've been more consistent than the other teams I mentioned. San Jose is a team of streaks, and you just don't exactly know what you're going to get. But based on pedigree, based on reputation, the Sharks are going to play their way into this mix. Nashville, it's got to come around, doesn't it? They added Matt Duchene. Look at their blue line. We all like it. You like their goaltending. So how do you handicap which teams now fall out? The math tells you that Edmonton, whether they get in or not, the Oilers should be able to hang around long enough to be in the conversation in March. They've been able to put enough points in the bank so far, and they've got two of the best players on the planet. Arizona is about as consistent as it comes, and they just don't allow anybody to score. Elliot Friedman termed them, and I know he got this from somebody, but he's the one who put it on the air. He termed them Islanders West. Yeah, that's what they've been. 70 goals against, that's it. They just don't allow anyone to score. And they're doing it the exact same way as last year. And what if they add Taylor Hall? So you tell me how you handicap the West right now. It's a compelling race. There's a lot of teams in it. This is exactly what the NHL wants. It's exactly what the system with both the salary cap and the loser point, that's exactly what this system is designed to do. And I've used this term before, but I'll use it again. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable if you are a fan of a team in the Pacific Division, because it's going to be like this all year long. There are going to be weeks. There are going to be months where you say, okay, this looks like a playoff team. And then there are going to be others where you go, geez, I don't know if we're going to get above that bar. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do it. Look at what this team has just strung together. It's going to be a mix of runs the rest of the way. Can you get your team going for a couple of weeks, pick up some points, make yourself feel better, and then when you start heading in the other direction, how quickly can you stop the slide? That's where we're at with the Pacific Division. And now that you've got teams from the Central starting to play better hockey, I said Winnipeg is overachieved. Dallas, who quite knows about Dallas? They got an overtime win last night over Winnipeg, despite giving up two third-period goals to allow that game to go beyond regulation. And Minnesota now complicates this matter. Sarah McClellan covers the Minnesota Wild, formerly covered the Arizona Coyotes, and she joins us now to talk about this run the Wild have been on. Sarah, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I'm not Minnesota Wild good, but I'm all right today.
I don't know if any of us are Minnesota Wild good.
Well,
right now.
Here's the thing. Who forgot to tell them they were supposed to be bad? We all thought this was going to be a bottom feeder in the West.
You know, it felt that way at the start, that like maybe this was going to be like quicksand and it would just be so hard to claw out of. And just the way the team was losing and making the same mistakes, it just kind of felt like, okay, maybe this is the tone being set for the entire season. But, you know, I think, you know, you kind of looked at a broader perspective and realized, okay, you know, there's so many of these games are on the road. They're not really home right now. They're in some tough buildings. You know, maybe they could start to chip away at this once the schedule started to ease up and, you know, they started to maybe gain some mojo and some confidence. And that's what's happened. I think it's just kind of been a snowball effect of the other way, in that they kind of got over that rough October and a very rigorous start on the road. Overall, 20 of their first 30 are on the road, which has only been done one other time in NHL history. And so they just kind of started to, I think, believe and gain some momentum. And now they've gotten points in 11 straight and won 5 in a row and sit in a playoff spot in early December. Who would have thought that was possible? But it's the reality that they have right now, and to try to kind of keep up with that.
In your opinion, who's been the MVP of this 8-0-3 run?
You know what? I think the goaltending has really set the tone, and so that's been, you know, Alex Stalock mostly, but rookie Kaapo Kähkönen's kind of come in too, and delivered two wins, you know, during this 5-game run, and you know, obviously different players have kind of played the hero role. Up front, they've had a depth of scoring, and their blue line shipped in, but I do think it kind of starts with goaltending and just that steadiness and. You know, the fact that I don't think it's lost them any games. And I think that's why that you know, they've been able to corral points. And I would say actually last night was probably the poorest showing that goaltending's given them amid this run, giving up four goals. And yet the team still found a way. You know, Stalock after the game said, I was not at my best, and they won this for the goalie. And that just seems to be the way that runs like this can kind of get contagious, and teams find different ways to win. And that just seems very much indicative of the Wild right now. They're not finding ways to lose. They're just finding ways to win. And, you know, they've been on runs like this before. It was just a few seasons ago that they set the franchise record with a 13-game point streak. So it can get kind of contagious and get on a roll. And that's what they needed, obviously, after such a poor start, though.
Sarah McClellan covers the Minnesota Wild for Star Tribune Sports. She joins us here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Bill Guerin took this operation over, and people wondered what his imprint would be. Based on the contractual situations, everyone went, I don't know what he can really do. Where is he at with what he has right now in Minnesota?
You know, I think he's still in evaluation mode. And I think the fact that the Wild was able to get on this run is in part because of a fresh set of eyes coming in Bill Guerin. Because if this was an older regime, I'm not sure if it would have been patient with a 1-6 start and a 4-9 start and not tried to make some changes and make some moves at the end of October. But Guerin came in and wanted to give the current lineup as constructed time to play, and felt that it was a veteran group that deserved that opportunity, deserved that window of time to try to show what it has. And now it's paid off, because if he would have been more reactionary at the end of October, who knows if this would have been possible. I guess you can argue if this is the right, you know, direction for the franchise overall. You know, is this a team that would have been better served with, you know, getting higher draft picks and retooling that way? I guess that's, you know, a conversation for maybe the higher ups to decide. But right now, this is a team that's proving it's competitive and that it can compete in this Central Division and Western Conference. And you know, that experience seems to be what's guiding them right now, instead of being kind of an albatross. So it's tough to say where it goes from here. I know Guerin has kind of pressure points shaped in mind of when he feels that, you know, will be really telling measures of where this team is at, and that perhaps weighs what he does with this team. But so far, the patient approach has certainly paid off.
Jason Zucker leads this team with 21 points. He was supposed to be on another roster if all reports were to be believed. How has he been able to put that spectacle behind him and lead this team in scoring?
Yeah, I think part of it was kind of like a fresh start that everyone got with Bill Guerin coming in, Paul Fenton getting dismissed in the summer. You know, I think the fact that just he knew someone new was going to be, you know, at the helm of this evaluation process. So I think that was part of it. But I think he's really found a groove lately with his line mates and the consistency that the Wild has been able to have in rolling out pretty much the same set of lines. There's been a few tweaks lately, you know, with Mikko Koivu having an injury, but he's really gotten in a groove with Eric Staal and Matt Zuccarello. And that line's been pretty dangerous most nights. I think last night they combined for 6 points. And so he really attributed to the chemistry and the kind of the rhythm that they've found. And again, it just kind of showcases the value that he's had as someone who can be, you know, a reliable goal scorer in this league, which he's been since, you know, since he's been with the Wild, and maybe in that sense kind of helps explain why his name is out there in trade rumors.
People also wondered if Kevin Fiala was long for the Minnesota Wild. Obviously, the former GM brought him in, had experience with him in Nashville. How has he played so far? I can see the point totals, but you watch him game in, game out.
Yeah, you know, there's been spurts where it was up and down. I think early it was more down than up, but lately he's been a steadier contributor, and I think that's the key for Kevin. I think that's what will really, you know, kind of define his career, is if he can be a factor on a night-in, night-out basis, and he's been more of that lately. He's been involved, and I think, like I said, before Koivu got hurt, he was on a line with him and Zach Parise, and they were one of the steadiest and most consistent contributors that the Wild has had. They really looked like they'd found some chemistry in a niche. So you still see flashes of that potential of someone being a dynamic top six forward, and he has been that at times for the Wild this season, but the challenge is just doing it consistently. I think that's still probably the test that's ahead for him, but this is the best he's looked since he was acquired from Nashville, and that's encouraging for the Wild. I think that was another player that probably benefited from a fresh start, being here from the jump, And he's a player the Wild needs. He's playing in a spot in the lineup where he gets a lot of opportunity, and they need him to do something with it.
The Minnesota Wild are the hottest team in the NHL. Sarah McClellan covers them, and she's speaking with us here on the Scott Rintoul Show. The two guys that jump out to me, if I look at this run and I say, okay, if I haven't been watching the Wild, who must have contributed? Devan Dubnyk hasn't been here for a lot of it. You talked about Stalock and how good he's been. Ryan Donato, he had such an impact when he came over from Boston. He's had a very slow start. What's been behind that struggle?
Yeah, you know, he's been in a different spot in the lineup this season compared to last season, where he kind of came in from the trade from Boston and kind of was given like a top six role, was putting a lot of pucks on net and was just getting a lot of points. Now this season, with the way the lineup has shaken out and the chemistry that's been formed, like I said, with those top two lines, he's in a fourth line role, and he's actually been a healthy scratch at times too. He got in the lineup yesterday because of Koivu's injury, and Marcus Foligno returned last week, so that's kind of pushed him back to being a bubble player. And I think that's probably been his biggest adjustment, is, you know, kind of realizing he's not necessarily in a position to be that point per game type player that he was very close to being last season with the Wild, but trying to find other ways to contribute and make a difference. And he's done that to his credit. You know, he's chipped in offensively here and there, which the Wild likes because it points to the depth scoring that they need to be successful. But just applying pressure, you know, he committed two penalties on Sunday, and you know, he came out of the lineup the next game, but it wasn't because of that. You know, he still was able to apply pressure on that fourth line. They still were able to draw penalties. And it was just a matter of giving someone else and Victor Rask a look, who actually hasn't also merited sitting, even though the Wild now is 13 forward before Koivu got injured. So I think it's just adjusting to a new assignment in the lineup. And, you know, if he gets that opportunity and gets those minutes, just capitalizing on them.
If you're Bill Guerin, is this the best time to start moving pieces? Your team's hot. People are all of a sudden taking notice. Some guys are on decent runs. If you're running the team right now, Sarah, is that what you're doing?
That's a tough spot to be in because, you know, I think as much as Bill has come in and this is his first stint as GM and he is the manager and he is the captain in charge of this ship, I think, you know, he probably might still remember what it's like to be a player. And players play. Players care about winning. And, you know, he's not too far removed from being in that competitive vibe. And so I wonder if that will affect, you know, his outlook ultimately, because this is a group that is fighting and clawing right now. And it made a really impressive climb to get back to relevancy after being near the bottom of the league for most of this season. And I wonder if that, you know, maybe buys this group again some more time to try to see what it has. But ultimately, you know, his job is to get this team to be sustainable, a successful operation year after year. And that may require him to make some tough decisions at some point. So I think regardless of what happens on the ice, this is going to be a fascinating team to watch the rest of the way because of that potential dilemma of reconciling a present competitive team, but is it sustainable long-term to have that type of potential to be a contender, which this team has yet to be ultimately, and getting on that long playoff run these last few years since they brought in Suter and Parise all those years ago.
Well, it's funny. They are literally, to me, the NHL's version of that Paul Rudd gif that keeps going on social media. Who would have thought? Look at us. Look at us. Not me. That's literally the Minnesota Wild. I'm sure it's more fun and more pleasant for you to cover. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us this morning.
Sounds good. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too. That is Sarah McClellan, covers the Minnesota Wild for the Star Tribune. They're just defying expectation. And the smart long-term plan, I think, is the one I outlined at the end. All right, you've got some guys who are going a little bit now. Do you have a piece that another team that needs a jump start says, we could use that. We can move off of that guy. No one thought they were going to be in this conversation. And for the veterans, they're not going to apologize. They're going to play hard. They're going to see if they can defy all expectation the rest of the way. But Minnesota, all of a sudden, just finds itself in the mix. And that's the interesting thing about this conversation in the West to me. And I want your input on this. The teams you've been watching and the stocks going up and the others dropping, there isn't a lot of consistency. There isn't a lot of consistency. Look at San Jose. Look at Dallas. Look at Minnesota. They have been teams of streaks. And that's the general nature of the NHL, but they've been more bipolar than most in those regards. San Jose looked like it buried itself. Same deal with the Minnesota Wild. Dallas, same deal. And now all of a sudden they hold playoff spots and you're not really sure what to think of them. Well, were you the team that started slowly, but now you've gotten it together and you'll be fine the rest of the way? Or in the case of Dallas, which got a much-needed win last night but had lost four straight, are you going to be like this all season? Are you going to fluctuate between they might never lose again and I'm not sure they're ever going to score again? Hit me up. We've got the text rolling in. We'll get to your feedback next as well. What they're saying is on the way. Excellent conversation coming at the bottom of the second hour. We're going to straddle both sides of the Rockies. Ian McIntyre, Eric Francis. We're going to have a conference call, if you will, talk about the Pacific Division. And coming up next, I promised you the plot twist. They have just the guy to do it, and it would be the ultimate NFL version of a WWE move. We'll outline it for you right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
Paul Mrazek makes the save and takes a swipe at Joe Thornton, who levels Mrazek.
Boy, he went right to the throat. Peter did not embellish this thing at all. I mean, there's no way that you would ever think this is coming from Joe Thornton. Catches him right in the jugular.
Sounds like a scene out of the WWE. That's exactly what it sounded like, and maybe that's a good theme for this segment because we have a plot twist for you that would be very WWE that we would love to see in the NFL. But that was Joe Thornton throat-punching Peter Mrazek. You decide based on the highlight whether you saw it last night, whether you look it up today, seek it out on social media. You decide how much, if at all, Mrazek flopped. And it's funny to hear the two different accounts of it. I heard both broadcast calls last night. Peter didn't embellish this at all, and, oh, man, look at him go down. Thornton barely touched him. It's pretty amazing stuff. It really is. It just depends which way you're viewing that game last night. The Canes are having fun with it. This is my favorite thing I've seen so far on Friday morning. So Mrazek goes down after the, quote-unquote, throat punch from Thornton, and obviously a scrum ensues, all of that stuff. So they go to practice today. One of the Canes got out there beforehand and had someone lay down on the ice or just did a cartoon configuration of they basically took some black spray paint on the ice and did a fake chalk outline and wrote 34 on it. Mrazek right beside the goal where the incident happened last night. Awesome stuff from Carolina. That team likes to have a little fun. We found that out last year. I liked it. There were some people around hockey who didn't. We all know a bunch of jerks is what ensued. Did you see what they did last night? They went at home last night. They throw on Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine. Come on, baby. Shake your body. Now do the conga. That's what they did. They did a conga line last night. Svechnikov led a conga line after the win. I think it's funny. I think it's fun. There's some people who aren't into it last night. But that was one of the scenes from what was a very busy night on ice. And we're gauging you today. We're gauging where you're at around the 30-game mark with the Pacific Division. Which team do you have the most confidence in right now? Which team do you say, I like their staying power? It's been tough to read. Arizona's first, 38 points. Calgary sixth, 32 points. It's a tightly knit pack. Oilers all of a sudden find themselves in second. They don't actually control whether they lead the division or not. After tonight, Coyotes play again. Oilers hosting the Kings tonight. Where's your confidence level at? It's certainly not Boston Bruins' confidence level. They lost last night, but the Bruins do what really good teams do. So they lose at home in overtime, but they find a way to get a point. They should have been out of that game, but they get three third-period goals. I know it's Chicago. I know that's not a great team. But when you find clubs like that that are playing a little bit of desperation hockey, Alex DeBrincat, we talked about Calgary getting a bunch of slump-busting goals last night. Alex DeBrincat gets a slump-busting goal. He's been like Johnny Gaudreau. DeBrincat had 41 goals a year ago. And like Johnny Gaudreau, he scored his sixth of the season last night. It has been a very slow start for DeBrincat. So they get that early in the third, only to watch Boston fight back. And the Bruins lose in overtime, but they find a way to get a point. They're like the Capitals in that way. They're like the Blues in that way. Even when they're not at their best, they generally find a way to carve something out. And we don't think of the Jets in the same caliber, but the Jets did that. And when you're in a good run of form, you find a way to get those points. Patrick Laine, we told you this, how much he loves playing against the Dallas Stars. Didn't score yesterday, but guess who was in on what happened in the third period? Patrick Laine assists on the game-winning goal. I have no idea. If you go watch the replay of the game-tying goal between the Jets and the Stars, I have no idea at that point of the game, with a team that's struggling, with a team that decided to scratch Alex Radulov last night to send a message to the veterans in that group and to him specifically, I have no idea how Mark Scheifele, with 45 seconds to go, is by himself in the slot. Hanging out by himself. All of the Stars collapse to the right corner. Right corner if you're on offense, their defensive left corner. And there's Mark Scheifele. Last time I checked, he's fairly dangerous. He's been known to score a goal or two. Tied that game up. Stars escape. They breathe easier. They snap their four-game losing streak, and they get the overtime goal. Joe Pavelski taking care of business on the power play. But when you're having a good run, those are the results you get. And as Canucks fans have seen at various times this year, Flames fans have seen, when it's going the other way, something just happens. It's been more like that for the Flames than it has been for the Canucks. But all of a sudden, Calgary's got three straight wins. First time this season. A very good opportunity this weekend to make it four. Vancouver got itself in the right direction, even though it wasn't great for 60 minutes the other night. And now it's the Buffalo Sabres coming in. Second game on their Western road swing. Lose last night in Calgary. 1 o'clock start tomorrow, so not a lot of rest for the Buffalo Sabres. And the Canucks, they should be very rested. Canucks, by the way, if you happen to be a Canucks fan listening, Nikolai Goldobin, he has been sent back down to Utica today. I don't think that comes as any surprise. You might be disappointed if you're a Canucks fan, but he's been sent back down to Utica. They're getting a little healthier. That likely means a Jay Beagle is available today. He's out playing road. I love when I see that stuff. I really do. And it happens in every community. It's not specific to Vancouver. If you missed this on social media or one of the news programs yesterday, Jay Beagle, who's been injured, but everybody says is such a great teammate. Where was he yesterday? He was in East Vancouver, and he just showed up and played some road hockey with a bunch of 6 or 7 or 8 year old kids. I love seeing that stuff. I love when athletes show up at minor hockey practices or they happen to go to a minor football practice. Makes such a big impact on the kids. It doesn't cost anything other than a little bit of time. I love seeing stories like that. Keep sending your texts in. You've got the text message inbox. You've got the fan feedback line. I like this from Elliot and Ladner saying that if you don't want to get knocked out, he's talking about Peter Mrazek, don't swing a goalie stick at a player and then charge at him. Good advice. Good advice. Terry and Burnaby, the question is, which team do you have the most confidence in right now? Terry says, the team I have the most confidence in today to be a playoff team in the Pacific, barring injuries, is Vancouver. And Terry says, hometown bias? No, but Terry thinks it's the best goaltending tandem of the group. Depth at every position, youth, confidence, experience, and most importantly, coaching. Mark my words, on this date come April, Travis Green is going to be a lock for a Jack Adams. That's the mic drop from Terry, who's calling his shot. Rick Tocchet's probably going to have a pretty good run at that too. I would challenge the best goaltending tandem. As good as Markstrom and Demko have looked, how do you look past Arizona right now? Kemper and Ranta have been sensational. They've allowed a grand total of 70 goals there this year. Darcy Kemper leads virtually every goaltending category right now. He's been out of his mind. And Antti Ranta, that's the guy they thought was going to be the number one. Pretty good backup plan. Things are going really well for Rick Tocchet's crew. I promised you the plot twist, and we will get to it. I'm Scott Rintoul. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. What they're saying is on the way. Great conversation coming with Ian McIntyre and Eric Francis at the bottom of this hour as we dive more into the Pacific Division, get a look at the Flames and Canucks from perhaps a couple of different vantage points. So last night in Chicago, after the Cowboys get somewhat embarrassed, the score didn't look terrible at the end, but it was kind of the same story as last night. You knew it was over before it was actually over. The Cowboys are supposed to go into Chicago last night after losing on Thanksgiving at home and not being able to get the job done in New England. Hey, That happens to a lot of teams, but New England seemed ripe for the picking at that time. Well, they're supposed to be a little bit mad, and they've had a full week. It's not your typical Thursday night football game. They had a week off to get ready for the Chicago Bears and Mitch Trubisky. And they're supposed to go into Chicago based on reputation and easily win that game. And everybody gets fat and happy on defense because, well, it's Mitch Trubisky. What's he going to do? Well, Trubisky looked great yesterday. We've been hard on him at times this year. He looked great. Dallas helped him look great because they refused to tackle. It's like they were allergic to it. It's like they thought they would have part of their checks taken away if they tackled anybody. They just didn't want to hurt anyone last night. They were awful. The score is 7 points. They got hammered in that game. It's not close. It wasn't 31-24. That was garbage time scoring from the Dallas Cowboys. You know it's bad when one of your longtime backers and a guy who is looking for the positive in everything he can with the Dallas Cowboys, I think he's fairly balanced, but if push comes to shove and it's a 50-50 call, I think Troy Aikman, more often than not, is going to lean Cowboys' way. He went in on them after the game last night.
Yeah, I don't know how you come back from this. I really don't, Joe. I mean, for the last 2 weeks, we've heard from them that they were going to get it going. They had a chance at home against the Buffalo Bills to finally beat a team with a winning record. That didn't happen. They got embarrassed in that game. They come here against a team that had a lot to prove but was struggling in a lot of areas, and it was the same old story. And so, yes, even though we knew before this game kicked off that it didn't matter if they lost, they were still going to be in contention, I don't know how you sell that if you're Jason Garrett or Jerry Jones or anyone when you have a performance like that to say, hey, but we're still alive. I mean, hey, we'll go play this week against the Rams, and it's all right out in front of us. And I don't think the players hear that. I wouldn't hear it if I were them. And this is on the players as much as it is on the coaches. They've got to be better. But I'm not sure I'd even talk to the team this week. I'd just say, let's just go play next week and you guys figure it out. But the talk is over, and it has been over for a while.
Jason Garrett kind of took that approach at the podium last night. Because they have such a long layoff before their next game, because they played the Thursday nighter, he's giving them the weekend off. He doesn't want to talk to them either. There's nothing quite as uncomfortable as watching a coach who you know is going to be dismissed in the near future having to get up and keep doing these press conferences. Jason Garrett is not long for that job. We've known that for quite some time. It would take a miraculous run to the Super Bowl to save his gig in Dallas. Even then, with Jerry Jones, who knows? He might change things. It was like earlier this season when Jay Gruden was going up to the podium after Redskins loss, and you knew he was going to get let go. And his final comment was basically something along the lines of, I'm going to show up tomorrow, and if my key works, I'm going to go to work. Well, he showed up the next day, and it didn't work anymore. So here's the ultimate plot twist. This is what would be so great from a wrestling point of view. Who just got let go in Carolina? Ron Rivera. He is expected to be in the running for the Cowboys job once Jason Garrett is dismissed, but nobody thinks that's happening until after the season. If you want to go full WWE on this, you get rid of Jason Garrett now and you hire Ron Rivera now. How about that plot twist? And I'm not talking hire Ron Rivera to a 5-year deal, which I'm sure he would want. He has the ability to command, but I'm just talking about the best storyline here. Listen, we're 6-7. We probably shouldn't win our division, but we still got a pretty decent shot to do that. Cowboys odds, by the way, like just to give you an idea, the Cowboys odds of getting into the playoffs going into last night were 77%. After losing to the Bears, they went down to 70. That's how bad the NFC East is. Oh yeah, you're still 70% shot to win this division, go to the playoffs. You hire Ron Rivera now? Imagine that spectacle. Boys, Jerry gave me a bag full of cash. Film that too. Show us that. Show him go to Ron Rivera's house with a bag full of money that says, I'm not giving you anything beyond this season. I can't promise you anything beyond this year. But here's a bag full of money to coach this team and give them a wake-up call. Imagine that scene. It is straight out of WWE. It would be great. And you've got just the owner who might consider doing it. Coaches rarely get fired mid-season with teams that are in contention. In football, almost never happens. Happens all the time in hockey. November's a bad month generally for hockey coaches, and we've seen it work. It worked last year with Craig Berube. So people say, hey, it worked for them. Why not work for us? Doesn't happen that way in football. Usually, Ron Rivera gets let go. Jay Gruden gets let go because the team has played itself out of the mix already. But imagine that plot twist. You know what? Let's hear from Jerry. Let's hear from Jerry after last night's loss. Let's get to what they're saying.
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
Might as well bump Jerry up to the top of this. While we're talking Cowboys football, I've got a really good stat for you later on in the show, by the way. Dak Prescott, he leads the NFL in passing yards. That statistic and those near the top, it's not all it's cracked up to be. I'll explain a little later. But let's hear from Jerry Jones. He's been doing this on the regular. Not every owner does this after every game, but Jerry Jones does. He also happens to be the GM, so he's been talking, and he was again last night.
They played us well enough tonight to deserve to win the football game. We did all of the things that you can do that cause you to lose football games in the game. That's where it is. Until we can get over here and we'll line up against the Rams, until we can win a football game, I don't care what kind of contention we're in, we've got to start playing and winning a football game so that we can be able to play better than we play tonight. We thought we would be able to play better defense against what they were doing. To their credit, they really were very effective against our defense, obviously, and I'm not telling anything anybody didn't know. So that's the way we look at it. We'll line them up here next week. We're going to go practice. And we're going to try to win a football game. And everybody that's in here that's healthy, and everybody that's healthy that's coaching will be coaching, and everybody that's in here that will be playing, and we just got to play better.
Yep, just got to play better. Just got to win a couple of games. Players who are here, they'll play. The coaches who are here, they'll coach. Doesn't sound real confident in Dallas, does he? That doesn't look like a playoff team, even though it probably is going to be a playoff team. They might only need to win one game the rest of the way to do it. That is the sad reality with this division. The sad sack, Dallas Cowboys lead it at 6-7. Philly could actually get into that same position. They could tie Dallas up. They actually play Dallas one more time this year. All they got to do is beat the New York Giants on Monday. That seems pretty reasonable, but Philly lost to Miami last week. There is zero confidence in any of those teams right now in that division. Dallas might be able to win this division by winning one more game.
We got a good text in here from Terry in Calgary. He says he's been a Giants fan since 85, hasn't seen a division this bad. He says, I think that all of the head coaches will be let go at some point, either during or after the season. We've already seen it happen in Washington. Jason Garrett, we expect to be let go. Pat Shurmur certainly wouldn't surprise anyone. Now, I do think Doug Peterson is probably the combo breaker there. He has a little more rope, but that gives you an idea. Like, we're talking about the potential for complete coaching turnover in the NFC East.
Yeah, Doug Peterson's not going anywhere. You win a Super Bowl, it buys you a bunch of time. Buys you a bunch of time, even if your team's not great. Remember, as poorly as Philly has played this year, and I was among those, like plenty of football fans who went, that's a pretty good roster coming into the year. Now, they've had a bunch of injuries. I'm not going to apologize completely because Carson Wentz hasn't looked like Carson Wentz should. They have had a bunch of injuries, but they were a playoff team a year ago. They won a playoff game last season. You're not getting a Super Bowl 2 years ago, getting a playoff win last year, and then because of this one down year, getting fired. That's not happening to Doug Peterson. You get a bunch of rope when you win a Super Bowl. If you go look at the guys who are employed right now, the longest tenured coaches in the NFL, what do they have in common except for Jason Garrett? They've all won a Super Bowl. The guys who've been in their job since 2010 or earlier have all got a ring. It keeps you around for a very, very long time. I understand the point, though. That division is trash. It's the worst division, I think, since the Seahawks won the NFC West with a 7-9 record. And they actually got to win a playoff game because they got to host it. I think it's a travesty that you can be that bad and host a playoff game when so few teams get in, but those are the rules as they write them right now. Good text from Terry. Thank you very much for that contribution. Moving back to hockey, Elliot Friedman making his Friday rounds. He's on Sportsnet 960 every single Friday morning with Boomer and the boys, and wanted to talk about this upstart situation in Arizona.
Well, right now, if we were handing out the Vezina Trophy today, Darcy Kuemper would be the winner. You know, it's actually kind of interesting. We've been talking about how they've been better and how they've been better. In their last two games, Columbus and Philly, they haven't been great, but Kemper's been dynamite. He was really good last night. I thought overall Philly was a much better team, but Kuemper just did it. You know, I think they play with a lot of structure. You know, earlier in the year, somebody kind of called them Islanders East. I see a lot of Islanders West. They called them Islanders West. I see a lot of similarities, a lot of structure, a lot of people knowing their roles. Last couple games, they haven't been great, but Kemper's been dynamite. And the other thing, too, is Kessel finally got going last night. He got a couple of points. He'd been not good. I think they're big into it for Taylor Hall. I think I mentioned it earlier in the week on the afternoon show. I think they're big into it for Taylor Hall. I think they see this as a year where they kind of want to take a little bit of a shot. But, you know, I like the way they play. The other thing, too, is they've made a lot of bets, Dean. And I don't know how many people believed in those bets, Keller, Schmaltz, guys like that. You know, it looks like, you know, some of those bets, at least early off, they look pretty good.
We were talking about this earlier this week on another show I host after this one. My co-host and I on Canuck Central were talking about identity and how there are a number of teams in the West that are in and around the playoff bubble, but you're not quite convinced as to what their identity is. Nashville is a good example of this. We know what we think Nashville's identity should be, but do we really have an identity of the Nashville Predators? If they're going to start winning games and they're going to move up the standings, Nashville had better get back to being a better defensive team, which we think is kind of their identity. But really, their identity is an open run and gun, score a whole bunch of goals, but allow too many team this year. Arizona has a very clear-cut identity, and they have the same kind of buy-in that the Islanders have, which is why it's a very good comparison. We're not going to be flashy, boys. But we're going to be very detail-oriented. We're going to be five-man units. We're not going to be that much fun to watch, but we're going to win games. That's what Arizona's done. Fewest goals against in the West right now. Sensational stuff from Rick Tocchet's crew. As far as results go, you might not want to watch them play very much, but they are going to win games. And if they add Taylor Hall to that mix, how does that change what you think about the Arizona Coyotes? Taylor Hall dragged a team that was not quite as sound into the playoffs a couple of years ago in the Eastern Conference. They weren't as good defensively. They didn't have that kind of goaltending, and he dragged that team in. Now, I know he, like the rest of the Devils, haven't been very good to start this year. They had that guy. It changes the way you look at them. Adding Phil Kessel is one thing, because we know where Phil Kessel's at in his career. And he scored a couple of goals last night. Good for him. He rolls back into Pittsburgh tonight. Interesting scene. I think they'll salute him pretty well. But you had Taylor Hall, you feel a lot differently about the Arizona Coyotes suddenly. Good text coming in on the Dallas Cowboys situation. Strange but true, the 6-7 Cowboys have scored more points than the 10-2 Seahawks. The 6-7 Cowboys have also allowed fewer points than the 10-2 Seahawks. Dallas has also gained more yards than Seattle and allowed fewer yards than Seattle. Unsigned text, thank you very much. That is all true. I would say about the points scored, they played one more game. So Seattle will overtake that total this weekend. But your point is well made. When Dallas has won, it's won against bad teams, and it's bumped up its totals, and it hasn't allowed very many points. But they haven't won any. They haven't beaten anybody. Their best win today is against Philadelphia. Do you consider that a good win? I don't. Not at this point, I don't. Eric Francis, Ian McIntyre, we got a conference call coming your way next. We'll zip around the Pacific Division. Get the views of a couple of guys from either side of the Rocky. That's next on the Scott Rentoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rentoul Show.
Pass back to Skinner's intercepted. Lucic is knocked away, but it goes right to Anderson. He finds Dubé. In with Lucic. Plays it over. Lucic scores!
That one's been a long time coming. Milan Lucic scores his first goal as a member of the Calgary Flames last night. Comes at a good time. Comes when this team needs a win. They've had three of them in a row. They're keeping pace right now in the Western Conference. It was one of those slump buster nights at the Saddledome. Lucic got his first. Johnny Gaudreau snapped a streak. hadn't scored in 10 prior to the one he got last night. Sean Monahan, hey, he hadn't been goalless in that long. He scored one last week, but there's a guy who needs to get his goal total up. And the other goal comes from Tobias Rieder, who infamously did not score all of last season in Edmonton. He has two now. He got a shorthanded marker. That helped the Flames to their third consecutive victory. It's something Calgary did not do under Bill Peters prior to his dismissal this year. Win three straight. All of a sudden, here they go. Jeff Ward has them on a three-game winning streak. Jeff Ward hasn't lost so far. All good in Calgary right now as the Flames starting to get headed in the right direction. There are at least signs that they're going to have this thing turned around in the very near future. They're tied in the standings with the Vancouver Canucks. Same goes for the San Jose Sharks. Those teams, all three of them, tied with the Minnesota Wild. That's the point total, 32 points that puts you in the playoffs. Right now, Minnesota has the tiebreaker, but you get the idea. That's how it's going to be the rest of the way. Arizona leads this division right now. Coyotes with 38 points, and just got this great text in from Scott in Calgary who says, at this rate, we might have the most unsexy sounding Stanley Cup Finals headline, Coyotes versus Islanders. Ew, says Scott from Calgary. Two great stories, but I understand the sentiment. Neither of them jump off the page at you. You might feel a little differently about Arizona if Taylor Hall ends up there. They might have a little more appeal. Little more curb appeal, if you will. Edmonton sitting second right now with 37 points, hosting the LA Kings tonight. Edmonton got beat by Ottawa, so they'll be in a great mood up there. The Kings head to Calgary tomorrow. Vegas in between that bunch I described with 32 points and the Edmonton Oilers. Vegas sits there with 35 points. That's the answer that's been coming back most often. When I asked you which team you got the most confidence in the Pacific Division, most people still go with Vegas. But Arizona's been the most consistent team to date. It's the reason they're 38 points on top of the Pacific Division. We promised you a conference call. We have one for you now. In Calgary, Eric Francis, a Flames insider in Vancouver, Canucks insider Ian McIntyre, both of Sportsnet. Gentlemen, welcome you both to the program for this conference call.
Thanks for having us. Thanks, Scotty.
Hello, Eric. Hey, you guys feel free to talk. I don't mind just turning off my mic. I do want to start in Calgary. I do, because the Flames get a much-needed win last night. Jeff Ward has not lost since taking over the interim head coaching position, which is pretty remarkable, Eric, given the spectacle of the Bill Peters situation.
Yeah, they've quietly gone about, you know, winning 9 of their last 10 points, and they're in that four-way tie for the last wildcard spot, as you mentioned. It kind of goes against conventional wisdom, against all odds. I mean, this team is still continuing to struggle scoring goals. Johnny Gaudreau and Sean Monahan, kind of the engine of this team, have both been dormant all season long. They have 6 and 7 goals, respectively. If not for David Rittich, this team would be below the LA Kings in the standings right now. And, you know, I know we're going to start talking about the division and such, but really, the only team that I still think, you know, has no business even being in the conversation, and it won't be long until they're out of the conversation, are the Kings. Yet the Kings have beaten the Flames both times they've played this year. You know, I still don't know if the Ducks are a legitimate team yet. You know, they're obviously trending in the right direction. But other than that, it's amazing, isn't it, guys, how wide open this Pacific Division is. I still think there are a couple frauds in there, and I'm not sure I'm ready to say who they're going to be. But can I just throw out a question to Ian?
Of course.
Which of the two teams surprises you most that are in this conversation right now? Vancouver or Edmonton?
Well, you know, I'm actually not surprised much by either, but I would say probably the bigger surprise is Edmonton. I thought Edmonton would be better with Ken Holland there and Dave Tippett and some better structure, not just on the ice, because Todd McClellan is a great coach, but just organizational structure. I figured they'd be headed in the right direction. I'm a little surprised how well they've started. The Canucks, most people thought they'd be better, and it's just a matter of degrees. And at times, the Canucks look a lot better. At other times, such as most of November, they look marginally better than last year, but at the end of the year, they're going to be better. Whether they're good enough to be in the playoffs, we'll see. But having watched Edmonton a couple of times recently against Vancouver in the team's split games last weekend, I don't know that Edmonton can do this for the whole year, because we know how great McDavid and Draisaitl are, but when you actually watch Edmonton closely, it's all about them. I mean, there really isn't much else other than those two guys. And they're the best two players in the NHL. If you had the Hart Trophy ballot right now, those would be two of the three finalists, which is incredibly rare for one team. But there just isn't enough around them. And as much as I admire those two guys, I don't know that they can do this, carry that team for 82 games the way they have. Already we're seeing Draisaitl kind of play not as well as he did earlier. I'm not really surprised by either of those teams. I thought that Vegas would do a lot better than they have, and I would concur with the idea that over 82 games, they're going to be the team at the top. But, you know, Anaheim and L.A. are about where I thought they'd be. It's just the bottom isn't as low. Like, L.A. is better than maybe what some people thought they would be. And everything is so condensed because no one's running away with the division. No one's falling out of it. I think there's a veneer that LA and Anaheim are still in it, but I don't really think they are. I don't think Anaheim is good enough either.
We all know why the Oilers are doing their thing, guys, because of Draisaitl and McDavid. And yes, as a team, they've overachieved. While we're on that topic of overachievement, hey, everybody expected Matthew Tkachuk to be good this year. Everybody expected JT Miller to be good. But I think both of those guys have exceeded early season expectation. Who has jumped over that expectation bar more?
Well, for me, just from afar, Miller. I mean, I've seen Matthew Tkachuk all 4 years now, and the progression every year is amazing. And his first year was damn good, too. So, I mean, I'm not surprised. As a hockey card collector, I could tell you I've been loading up on Tkachuk rookie cards because I think this guy is going to be a superstar, literally have the superstar tag on him. It'll probably take a trade, you know, or move to the States for him to be on a more prominent team. But at some point, this guy's going to be recognized league-wide as one of the superstars and obviously a future captain somewhere, if not here. But Miller, so Miller shocks me. I have to be honest, I didn't know all that much about him when he came over, and I sense that the Vancouver market, I know they weren't all that thrilled with the trade and the price they paid to get him because they certainly didn't think the ceiling was this high. But yeah, to me, that's a no-brainer. JT Miller, what a fantastic start to the season he's had. And to me, that's a big part of why I see Vancouver as quite a surprise right now. I'm not going to put them in the category of fraud. I put Edmonton in that category. I don't see them making the playoffs under many circumstances, but yeah, Miller's been just fantastic this year.
Eric, you buried your lead. Did you just
again?
Did you just allude to the possibility that Tkachuk will be playing somewhere else twice?
Oh yeah, he's an American-born player. His father was a nomad. You know, played all over the league. My guess is the advice from his dad in those quiet conversations is one day you're going to have to spread your wings. There, you know, you love Calgary, Matthew. We love Calgary. It's a great organization, great city. They treat you like gold. But at some point in time, you're probably going to have to go spread your wings somewhere else. And I sense the same with Johnny Gaudreau. There's no chance Johnny Gaudreau will be here after two more years. I'd be surprised if he's here after this year. Yeah, again, maybe I'm burying leads all over the place, but this is the way I feel. I think there's significant change ahead for the Flames.
Well, I think Tkachuk, you know, last year we were talking about Mark Giordano and how much he made the Flames go around him. And to me this year, again, viewed from 20,000 feet, Matthew Tkachuk is their MVP. But when we're talking about surprises, I failed to mention Arizona. I mean, Arizona, people, they're kind of like the Canucks. People thought they would be a little bit better, and they're a lot better. And it's hard to figure out how they're doing it other than Darcy Kemper is one of the most underrated goalies in the league, I think, for what he's done.
and that defense. I remember last year when Arizona came into Vancouver and they kind of choked the life out of the game. And Travis Green said, you know, how good they are defensively and how hard they are to break down. And I thought that was just, to be honest, I thought that was coach babble, you know, because everybody always says how the other team is so great. But when you look at them this year, they've got almost nobody scoring. Phil Kessel has what, five goals, six goals, and minus a ton. It's all about that defense, and it's all about the goaltending. And they play such a solid game. They are a team that I think could survive to the end of the year. I'm not sure quite at the same clip that they are right now, but I think Arizona is going to be there at the end in some form.
Yeah. I think most people would agree with that. Ian McIntyre, Eric Francis, two Sportsnet insiders joining us for this conference call here on the Scott Rintoul Show. I think most people agree with that because they've been so consistent. Because they're like the Islanders, they just don't allow you to score. So if Arizona's going to be there, Edmonton feels like it could be a fraud. Which of the two teams hovering around 32 points that were expected to be better, Calgary or San Jose, do you see as a second-half riser?
Well, I don't see many circumstances under which the Flames are not a playoff team, and I hesitate to say that because it sounds like a homer, but it's just hard to fathom that a team that finished second overall last year in the National Hockey League, not just in points but in goals, is now hovering near the bottom of the National Hockey League, and I think they're 27th in goals so far. At some point, you know, the depth of this team is going to have to come through with the Elias Lindholm being a 30-goal scorer, Johnny Gaudreau, you know, a 30-goal scorer, Sean Monahan, a 30-goal scorer, Matthew Tkachuk's a 30-goal scorer. At some point, some of these guys are going to have to start to bust out. Maybe we saw a glimpse of it last night because Monahan and Gaudreau both scored. But either way, I the goaltending here, you know, Ian said earlier that Tkachuk's the MVP here, and I respectfully disagree. I mean, the runaway MVP for this team is David Rittich. Without David Rittich, this team is below the LA Kings, without question. He's kept them in games they have no business being in, and we just haven't seen a spark from the Calgary Flames yet. I think both the Flames and the San Jose Sharks are in the playoffs this year. I bet money on it. So we got to start figuring out where the other teams are going to drop, which teams they're going to knock them out. And to me, 30 games into the season, it's a little too early to do that, because it's a small sample size. But I see no circumstances under which either one of those teams are not in the playoffs.
Well, I would take that bet, Eric. If you give me that they're both in, I'll bet that someone is not. But I can't tell you which of the two. I think Calgary's probably less risk because, as you say, they've got these guys who are underachieving offensively. And at some point, I mean, Gaudreau and Monahan, they're too good players to not start scoring at a greater clip. But I had reservations about that team viewed from afar when the season began, mostly because they seem to rely so much on Giordano and Rittich. And Rittich, I hear what you're saying, Eric. I need to see a larger body of work. In the same way that it took me a long time to come around to Jacob Markstrom as a starter in Vancouver, because I don't want to see that for 1 year. I don't want to even see it for parts of two. I want to see that 3 or 4 years. And so I'm not convinced on Calgary. I think that the coaching change is actually a good thing for them. And it was reprehensible what Bill Peters did. And he hasn't come out and defended himself. But the Akeem Alou stuff, the racism stuff, that's just awful. But the fact is that team needed a change anyways. It needed a shakeup. And San Jose, I just don't know what to make of them. Because at times they've looked good. They've looked like the old San Jose Sharks. But at other times, they look like yesterday's team. You know, they've got these older players. They've got these huge contracts that they're carrying, so there's not much maneuverability there for Doug Wilson. And Martin Jones, just year after year now, has put up well below average numbers. And in this day and age, and I know that the game, thankfully now, is more about scoring and less about defending and choking teams down the way that Arizona is still doing it, and the Islanders still do it. It's more about scoring, but I just don't know that Martin Jones is a goalie who can play well enough over a full season to get his team in, because the margin for error isn't there in the Sharks that it once was. So I think one of those two teams is not making the playoffs. It stun me if both. I'd be more surprised if both got in, to tell you the truth, than, well, no, probably I'd be more surprised if they both missed. But I think one of the two will miss.
So San Jose's given up more goals than any team in the Western Conference. They're minus 13 when it comes to goal differential this year. Those three teams have interesting goaltending situations. I know we would handicap San Jose at the bottom of the three in Vancouver, Calgary, and San Jose. So you guys tell me, yes, Riddick's been fabulous, but can he keep up this workload? Vancouver, they've got the tandem thing going on. Which goaltending situation do you trust more over this season?
Well, you know, I'd have to let Ian speak to the Vancouver situation. So comparing them is tough, but all I can tell you is there's been tremendous faith in David Riddick organizationally. Certainly the fans love this guy and have always felt like he's their next Kiprusoff. And people don't speak in those terms, but I think people finally feel like maybe this is the guy who we can hang on to for a number of years, and he could be that stabilizing force that Calgary's only had basically twice in the 40-year history of the franchise. It was Vernon and Mika Kiprusoff. So I would lean towards, you know, Kiprusoff, but I remember, David Riddick, but he has a history, and it's, again, a small sample size because he hasn't played that much. Last year, 48 games was the most he'd ever played. He has a history of second half of the season, you know, his numbers, you know, kind of always pale in comparison to the first half. So there's a great risk that they're running here in Calgary of overplaying him and the potential that he's burned out in the second half of the season. He stepped up his conditioning with that in mind. Also, I think Talbot is going to play a whole lot more over the Christmas period here in this month of December. And I think he's been good. He's just kind of had some bad luck. So I like the Calgary tandem a lot, but it harkens back to a conversation I had with Ian in the press box last year. I remember asking him, you know, tell me about your goaltending here in Vancouver. And I seemed to, and I hate misquoting guys, you know, I probably only do it every couple of days, but Ian, you tell me, I could have swore you said to me that you didn't think Markstrom was an NHL starter last year.
I don't recall saying that.
Okay, there you go again.
I have long wondered, is he a superior starter? Like, is he a starter that can give you 55 games and take you to the playoffs? But I've been impressed by him, you know, because he seems to be, when he's on his game, and he's had so much to deal with in his personal life, obviously with the death of his father and his father's, you know, terminal struggle with cancer that was ongoing when the season began. So it's hard to really gauge Markstrom, but he seems to me to be better again this year. I just think it's now a two-goalie league, and the fact that the Canucks have Demko and Markstrom, I think, just is a big advantage over the teams that are relying on one. And, you know, Cam Talbot, if he's going to be reliable in Calgary, well, it's going to be the first time in a while that he's been reliable, because he's been on a descending slope for a while. Riddick, I think Riddick has been great. Like I said before, I want to see a bigger body of work. But the problem is, he's headed to a 65-game season, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just so hard to do now. And so I think you need two to get to the playoffs. You only need one once you're there. But I think you need two to get there.
Final question, guys. 30 games in, these teams, I think Vancouver's closer to what we thought than Calgary is. They've been below expectation. How has that expectation changed in each market as to what a successful season has been?
Well, I guess I'll go first. You know, in Calgary, you know, anything less than getting into the second round was going to be considered a colossal failure this year, given the steps they took last year, given how deep this team is, given the stability around it. Well, that stability has been eroded with the latest, scandal, we'll use the word, I don't know, the cloud that's hung over this club the last couple of weeks, the TJ Brody injury scare they had. You know, that was pretty traumatic for all the players who saw that and thought perhaps they were watching, you know, a teammate struggle for his life. on the ice there. Expectations have changed. It's a good question. Right now, I think people are like, okay, we just got to get into the playoffs is what you hear fans say, you know, as opposed to making waves in the playoffs. I will say this, though. The expectations at the beginning of the season were such that if this team didn't win a first-round series, there were going to be significant changes to the core of this team, i.e. Johnny Gaudreau. And I still believe that if this team, well, certainly if they don't make the playoffs or if they don't at least win the first round or have a valiant effort in the first round, then I think you will still see some significant changes to the core, i.e. Johnny Gaudreau.
Well, it's funny how quickly expectations can change because at the start of the season, I think the Canucks being in a playoff race would have been seen as a nice thing, almost a bonus, you know, in conjunction with the ongoing player development. But man, that winning sure is intoxicating. I think October got a lot of people hooked. And so now I think the expectations have changed for them. I think there's still a lot less pressure on the Canucks than there is on the Flames because let's say that both teams finish with 88 to 90 points and just miss. Well, that's going to be a good season in Vancouver, and that's going to be an abject disaster in Calgary. So there is more pressure on Vancouver. Now that people have seen what they're capable of, you know, Quinn Hughes has been a huge game changer for this franchise. You know, Thatcher Demko giving them a big safety net and goal if Markstrom isn't right on top of his game. Expectations have changed. I think this team is capable of making the playoffs. I said at the start of the year that if they could stay healthy on defense, and in particular, if Edler and Tanev can stay healthy, I think the Canucks are a playoff team. And that in itself would be a huge achievement considering where they were the last 4 years.
Boys, well done. We'll have to cut the goodbye short because we're up against it. Thank you very much. This went extremely well. We'll do it again. Have a great weekend to both of you. That's Ian McIntyre and Eric Francis, two Sportsnet insiders. In Calgary, we're going to send you to Hockey Central. Here in Vancouver, I've got a way for you to pay for all of your holiday shopping, and I'll tell you what it is next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
It is Pettersson and shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
We're about to get a few answers. I think there is logical deduction that can lead you to one of them, but we're about to get a few answers as the Canucks set to hit the ice at 8 rinks in Burnaby for their practice. They're not going to have a pregame skate tomorrow because if they were, it would be at about 7 a.m. 1 o'clock game, Buffalo Sabres, Vancouver Canucks, Rogers Arena tomorrow. You got the afternoon game. Some people will complain about it. It's a great opportunity for families to get out to the game, people with young children, or if you just want to get your day going early. Bick and I talked about this on Canucks Central yesterday, and we'll talk about it an hour from now. Should remind you, Alex Hall joins us every single Friday on Canucks Central. We'll find out his play of the week. We'll get his breakdown on what is a light week for the Vancouver Canucks, and we'll zip around the hockey world and the Pacific Division with him as well. Get your game on early tomorrow. Go out for the night. Have fun. Game ends before 4 o'clock, likely. And you could just take in the sights and sounds of downtown. Should be a fun one tomorrow. Canucks and Sabres hopefully has a better vibe to it than that Stars-Canucks game last year. 1 o'clock start on Sunday, and it was just super sterile. But that building's been bouncing a little bit this year. Has a lot to do with the energy around the team, with the increased expectation. And as mentioned, we're going to get a few answers soon. Nikolai Goldobin sent back to Utica. I don't think that can be seen as a surprise. Jay Beagle also spotted out on the streets of Vancouver playing ball hockey with a few kids yesterday, which is great stuff. I love it. I love it when high-profile celebrities use a little bit of their free time to go have fun with kids. That was great yesterday to see Jay Beagle out doing that. It all leads you to think maybe Jay Beagle's in the lineup come Saturday. We're going to get to see the Lions today. We'll have an idea of where they're going for tomorrow. I'll roll those out to you as they come down. But yes, Nikolai Goldobin has been sent back to Utica. Some of you will shrug at that. Others of you will not be happy with that. and Ferland and Beagle, as reported by Dan Murphy right now, are both taking line rushes. So it's not just Jay Beagle, Michael Ferland taking line rushes today as well. Schaller in the on the fourth line with Beagle and Ferland. That's how they are lining up today out in Burnaby. The top line is together with Miller, Pettersson, and Besser. Bo Horvat between Tanner Pearson and Josh Levo. Adam Gaudette between Jake Virtanen and Antoine Roussel. That trio was very noticeable, very prominent against the Ottawa Senators on Tuesday. I don't think we can see that as a surprise. So those are your lines right now as the Canucks get set for the Buffalo Sabres. That's the game on Saturday. One after that is the Toronto Maple Leafs on Tuesday. A high-profile game, you all know that. Some of you roll your eyes because the national attention that comes with it. Well, they're not starting it at 4 o'clock, so you can be okay with that. It's a little bit earlier, but not a lot earlier. I believe it's a 6 o'clock start on Tuesday night. I'll check that, but I believe it's a 6 o'clock start. You know what you can win? Guess what you can win? And you don't even have to go to the game. Guess what you can win on Tuesday? At least $500,000. It's another one of those. It's another one of those 50-50s. You can buy those online. You can go to the game and buy them. You can ask somebody who's going to the game to buy them via proxy, if that's what you want to do. But we got another one of those coming up. Where does that jackpot get to? It's a minimum of 500 grand, but that thing could get to $1 million. Pretty decent way to pay for some holiday shopping, if that's the way you want to go about it. We'll continue to update you from Canucks practice today. As mentioned, Jay Beagle and Michael Ferland back on the ice. Beagle, that was not a surprise. Based on all of the things I gave you. Beagle out playing a little road hockey with kids. Godobin sent down. Michael Ferland, given the nature of his injury, that one comes as a little more of an eyebrow raiser. We knew he'd been skating. We knew that he was getting closer, but you just don't know with a concussion day to day. But Michael Ferland, the fact that he is on that line today, that is great news for the Vancouver Canucks. So they could potentially get back in the span of a couple of games, based on what we're seeing, Michael Ferland and on Antoine Roussel. It's big news for this team. Bad news for some guys. Means they're going to sit. Means they're going to eat some popcorn. I'm sure there aren't a lot of people here worried that Louis Erickson's going to be back in the press box. But getting Ferland and Roussel back, energy guys, physical guys on this roster. Michael Ferland, we haven't really seen what he can be with this team yet. Had the illness during training camp. Then he got hurt. He hasn't been able to get his feet under him. This is a guy they brought in to be a top six forward. This is a guy they thought was going to be on that top line. I had my reservations. I actually thought JT Miller was going to be a better fit there. It's played out that way. I'm not right about everything. I was right about that. He looks great on that line, but JT Miller's looked great on every line this year. They get Ferland back, and now that changes the equation. He starts on the fourth line, and this is the luxury once you get a guy like Roussel back into the lineup. He's still getting his legs under, and his cardio's not quite there yet. He's not up to the game fitness that he's ultimately going to be. But you get a guy like Roussel back. You have a guy like Levo, who is really a seventh forward. You probably want him on your third line, but you're okay playing him on your second line at times. Pearson kind of feels like that as well, but he's gotten it going a little bit lately. Overall, not at points this year, but overall, when you date back to last season, he's been a very good fit with Bo Horvat. It gives you time to get Ferland up to speed. And then once he's going a little bit, once Roussel's going a little bit, look at the different options this team suddenly has, depending on how they want to configure those lines. And we haven't even talked about Brandon Sutter yet. He's not quite back. That's when the interesting decisions really start to come. Tyler Mott, easy to forget about him, but remember how effective that fourth line was with Mott, Schaller, and Beagle. They were excellent when they were a trio earlier this year. The decisions get really hard then. Start to get really tough. Who are you scratching now? Who's coming out if you get Sutter back, if you get Mott back? Easy to leave Mott in the press box if you want. I don't think anyone anticipated him playing 82 games, but they're going to want to inject him at some point. And for penalty killing purposes, for fourth line purposes, Mott has done what he's been asked to do, and he has been an energy guy. We can have those conversations when those guys get back. But that's the situation the Canucks suddenly find themselves in. You've got the phone numbers. May have time for a phone call this segment. We're going to talk some NFL football at the bottom of the hour. Mike Dugar of The Athletic down in Seattle is going to join us. Big Sunday nighter coming up. A lot of implications around the NFL this weekend. Dallas continues to suck. Maybe bounce something off him about that. We'll get to that a little later on. 280-0650. If you want in on the Canucks conversation, Michael Ferland back at practice today. Jay Beagle back at practice day, both on the same line, playing with Tim Schaller on what looks to be the fourth line heading into tomorrow's afternoon tilt with the Buffalo Sabres. We've been talking a lot about the Pacific Division, and I do want your feedback on this. We're going to hear from Alex Burrows in a second, but I want your feedback on the Pacific Division. Eric Francis, Ian McIntyre, we just had a really good segment with the two of them. Conference call, we called it. One guy in Calgary, one guy in Vancouver, a look at the Pacific Division, a look at these two teams and where they shake out. The Vancouver Canucks, for all of the good, and there's been plenty of it, there have been plenty of good stories. It feels like we've talked about so many good stories with this team between JT Miller. Even though Pettersson hasn't been at his peak all season, he's still a point-a-game guy. He's a little bit better than that. We talk about Quinn Hughes. We talk about the goaltending, about Demko, the improved blue line overall. We've had a lot of good stories to talk about in Vancouver. So it feels like the Canucks should have more points than the Minnesota Wild. It feels like they should have more points than the Minnesota Wild, doesn't it? And that has less to do with the Canucks and more to do with the Wild. Because while you were sleeping, the Wild became the NHL's hottest team. They are 8-0-3 in their last 11 games. Since the start of November, they have been on a tear. 10-2-4 since that time. All of a sudden, a team that was supposed to be old, was supposed to be done, was supposed to be buried, actually has the tiebreaker with the Vancouver Canucks. That seems shocking today. It really does. But it does tell you this. The Canucks are going to have to get rolling at some point here. They're going to have to start getting on a lengthy win streak if they're going to compete for the wild card. The math tells you this. And we're just coming off a year in the National Hockey League where Colorado Avalanche got into the playoffs with 90 points last year. And we all said the same thing. And don't tell me you didn't. You all said the same thing that everyone else did. Well, it's going to take more than 90 points this year. Maybe it will. Maybe it will. But if you look at the teams that are tied for that wild card spot right now, the projected total is 90 to 91 points. So you might get in with that again, which means you're going to have to be 6 to 9 games over 500 the rest of the way if you want a playoff spot in the West. Do you see a Canucks team that is capable of doing that? Tanbeer busts us a call. We'll give him a line. Tanbeer, thanks for the call. What's on your mind?
Well, Scotty, this team, I've loved the way they've played so far, but looking at how tight the race is with the Pacific Division and the Western, Minnesota coming out of nowhere, and I thought they were going to suck, to be honest. And looking at the standings and looking at those games that they blew when they had a 5-1 lead against Washington and they had a 6-3 lead against Pittsburgh. And I'm worried that if it does come down to a few games, that those are the games we're going to look back at. Not just those games, but the games against the New Jersey Devils that we should have won because, that's not a good team. So looking back at those games, it really gives me a bit of anxiety because I want this team to make the playoffs. And I know it's not the end of the world to don't make it, but, you know, I think they can. And the addition of Anton Roussel and now Michael Ferland coming back, they have to make some decisions. And I'm hearing that they have interest in Tyler Toffoli, and that scares me because that could be giving up a B-plus prospect like a Tyler Madden or a Jack Rathbun, and I wouldn't want to do that. What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for the phone call, Tanbeer. I don't think they'd be in that price tag. They have too many bodies here. If the Canucks are going to get in on a Tyler Toffoli, for example, they got to move people out. So that business has to be taken care of first. And if they're moving people out, you would assume some type of asset is coming back. I don't know they can make those moves. There are teams out there that are rumored to be in the mix for forwards, but nothing's happened yet. And those same teams were rumored to be in the mix for forwards a couple of months ago, and Jim Benning hasn't been able to make anything move. They're going to have lineup decisions pretty quickly. And it's one thing to have Sven Berchi back down in Utica, and Nikolai Goldobin back down in Utica, and look at those as assets the Canucks can move. But we're talking about full-time NHL guys right now who are going to be sitting if this team gets just a little bit healthier. If Brandon Sutter, who's been skating with the team for quite some time, gets just a little bit on the right side of things. If Tyler Mott, who's been out for quite a while now, gets on the right side of things. Now you've got bigger conversations to have. The way the lines look right now, people can certainly live with that. There's no Louis Erickson up front. They're okay with what they see. Maybe you don't love Levo on the second line. Maybe there's somebody else you want to see there. But Roussel, once he gets up to speed, will be an option. Ferland, once he gets up to speed, will be an option. But what do you do when you get Sutter back? Gaudette's been great for this team. Adam Gaudette's been really good. He hasn't been great defensively. He hasn't been great in the faceoff circle. But offensively, Adam Gaudette's carrying his weight.
And we should mention, Scotty, we've got the full line report now from practice from our own Brendan Batchelor. And he has, on that third line, Gaudette and Sutter taking turns in between Roussel and Virtanen. So that's another indication that, as you said, we've got some hard lineup decisions coming here if Sutter is that much closer to getting back.
Doesn't feel like Adam Gaudette should be out of this lineup. And maybe you still want Brandon Sutter in that role. And maybe Sutter's role, and we saw this earlier this season, is alongside Adam Gaudette. And much like JT Miller has been taking all of the draws for Elias Pettersson, maybe Sutter's the guy who's taking those draws. And perhaps you believe you have two intelligent enough hockey players that when they get back in their D zone, they can switch D zone responsibilities. Maybe that's what you think. And as they skate forward, they crisscross. Who knows? However they go about it. Sutter has talked about that. He's been versatile for this team. No matter what you think of the contract, he's an important player for this group right now. And it's borne out, I should say, by the numbers. Beagle the same way. You might not like the contract, but go look at how they get killed in defensive zone draws when those two guys are in the lineup and Bo Horvat has to do it all by himself. This has been a talking point here. But yeah, they're going to have some decisions to make here pretty quick. So who comes out next? And it's easy to look at reputation or resume and say, wow, you can just sit down Tim Schaller. Tim Schaller's been good for this team. He really has. Is he more important than Tanner Pearson? No, he's not more important than Tanner Pearson. But the role he's been asked to fill, he has filled well. These are tough decisions, but they're good decisions. And they're the types of decisions that were no-brainers a year ago or 2 years ago. And now Travis Green actually has difficult ones to make lineup night to night. Let's see if Brandon Sutter is ready to go for tomorrow or if he's ready to go for the Leafs on Tuesday. Keep those conversations coming. I did want to get back to Alex Burrows. It was such a fun week reliving everything that happened, and we didn't have enough of an opportunity to replay just that great convo we had with him. And if you want to go check it out in its entirety, go back to our website, sportsnet.ca/650. It's there. He talked about a lot of stuff throughout the course of his career, but everybody wants to talk about Game 7, and he says it's one of the most wild games of his career. Not just the goal at the end. We all think of that. But remember, he scored earlier. He had a penalty in overtime. It was chaos for Alex Burrows on that night in a series that saw the Blackhawks roar back from three games down to force a Game 7 here in Vancouver. And this was Alex Burrows earlier this week recounting that.
Oh, no, for sure. I was for sure. I remember my teammates were too, that we had such a good group of guys. We liked each other so much. We liked to be at the rink so much together. And we were like first place in the league, first power play, first PK, best goals for, less goals against. Like, we had a really good team, and we had been together through some hard time the previous years, losing to Chicago in the second round. But that was our year. We knew it. That was our year. And now playing against the Blackhawks, up 3-0. Now it's tied 3-3. We knew how important that Game 7 was. And I remember we were staying at the Pac Rim in Cole Harbour, and to limit as many distractions as possible. And I remember driving with Kess to the rink that game, and we just knew we were going to find a way to get that, to win that game. And who knows what would have happened if we had lost that game. With maybe management would have been gone, maybe coaching staff would have been gone, all our teammates, maybe the Twins, Kess, Juice, Lou, me, myself, Hammer, like so many guys, who knows what would have happened. And so we didn't want it to end. not only for that playoff run, but for the we enjoyed being around each other, and we had to find a way to get it done. And I was so happy that we were able to win that game.
Well, and you're the guy who scores the goal, and everybody remembers the Slay the Dragon goal, Game 7, overtime. You get that. People might not remember you scored the other goal in that game for the Canucks as well, and they might not remember you were in the penalty box for 2 minutes in overtime. What were those 2 minutes like? Game 7, overtime, and you're sitting there in the penalty box watching the Blackhawks on the power
play. Well, for me, that game was the craziest game of my career. Like you mentioned, I scored the first goal, great setup by Ryan Kessler. And then in the third period, I don't know if you remember, but I missed a penalty shot. I got tripped on a breakaway, and I got a penalty shot, and I made the worst move that I've ever done in my career in a penalty shot. I didn't change my speed, didn't change my angle, that terrible shot. Like, it was the worst penalty shot ever. And even then, they got a power play late in the game, and they scored on the PK with like a minute left, and I was kind of involved in that situation where I feel I could have maybe prevented that goal. So that was another bad play. Then a penalty, that was the worst 2 minutes of my life, sitting with a lazy hooking penalty in the offensive zone in overtime, like terrible penalty. But I knew like my guys could pull it off for me. Everybody wanted to win so bad, so I knew they could pull it off. And we had pre-scouted them, like now it's game 7, so we know what they're trying to do in their power play. And I still remember we talked about that goal line play, and Lou read it perfectly. And obviously I would have liked Kevin to cut that pass, but Taze made that pass to Patrick Sharp, and Lou made that unbelievable shoulder save. And I think like everybody talks about the goal and slaying the dragon, but that save is why we kept playing and why I had an opportunity to score the game winner. So I'll forever remember that save for Lou, for saving my in the penalty box at that time. And who knows what the story would be different for sure if that goal would have gone in. I got a chance to score that big goal afterwards.
Alex Burrows won't be part of the Canucks tomorrow, but Duncan would like to see him part of the Canucks at some point, I'm sure. And he also says Alex Burrows, as he texts us in, the Subway text line 650-650, will make a great coach. His enthusiasm is palatable. Yeah, it was a fun week. It was a really fun week to relive Alex Burrows' career, what he meant to this team at the time, and what he continues to mean to fans in this city. I said it on Tuesday, and I'll say it again. It does feel like somewhere down the road, he's going to rejoin this organization.
Well, and Duncan brings up that he thinks Burrows is going to be a great coach. And what did we hear from everyone we talked to this week about Alex Burrows? We all know the underdog story and the pranks and what a pest he was. But everyone unanimously says he is an incredibly intelligent hockey player. And we saw that over the course of his career. You know, I was a huge Alex Burrows fan before I ever got into the media game. And it wasn't just all the fun stuff. For me, it was, I was so impressed with how he was able to get better every day. He started out as a grinder. Then he became a penalty killer. Then he got to play with the Sedins. He just improved so much, and you don't do that unless you're an extremely intelligent player. So, yeah, he does have a bright future in coaching, and it makes a lot of sense if the team wants to bring him back to the organization at some point.
We heard from so many of his old teammates this week leading up to Alex Burrows' night, in the wake of Alex Burrows' night, that I can't remember whether it was Kevin Bieksa or Ryan Kessler who made this point. But one of them said, I know everybody credits the Twins, and yes, they are the better players on that line, but it was Ed Jovanovski on Wednesday. He's on the starting lineup every single Wednesday. And Jovo said, people don't understand how smart you have to be to play with them. And he said, look at all the guys who got a chance. There were a lot of guys, and a lot of guys benefited, but they didn't have staying power. Because hockey IQ-wise, you can be told, okay, you're the guy who goes and gets the puck and then go to the right spot, which is the front of the net. That sounds easy in theory, but it's not as easy to execute. And this isn't a perfectly executed game. Things happen. You wind up in different spots. You wind up in different spaces. It's a read and react game. And it's an excellent point about Alex Burrows and his hockey intelligence. It's one that was taken for granted for far too long. It really was. And this guy is not the same player, and he is higher pedigree, and he's having a great season. But that's what I see in JT Miller as well, how smart he is on the ice. you can practice all you want with your shot and your passing and your line rushes, but nothing perfectly prepares you for how other people are going to react to you during a high-paced sport. You can have it all drawn up perfectly. Well, this is how I get to the net. Well, instead of one guy standing there, there might be two. Example to me, the play that he makes 2 games ago on the great cross-ice feed to Quinn Hughes, where he's in the offensive zone and he just decides to lean in on the defenseman, use the edge work, get all the way over to the right side of the ice. You think he practiced that specifically? No, zero chance. I'm sure he's worked on the edge work, but he just felt it in the moment. That's what's impressed me so much about JT Miller this year with his club. So much. Lineup conversation continues here. Sterling in Calgary. Schaller gets far too much credit. Watch the guy. He makes more mistakes and bad plays that cost the team goals than noticed by most and brings absolutely nothing other than a very bad and soft filler for the far better penalty killers that have been hurt. If Green chooses a useless plug like Schaller over Gaudette, he should be fired. Hell, I'd use McEwen over Schaller any day. He's faster, more skilled, and physical. He's not too chicken to fight like Schaller. Sterling, a big fan. Hoping that under the tree this year, there is a Tim Schaller 59 jersey. You don't have to be the biggest Tim Schaller guy, but that critique is over the line. He's not a useless plug. You think of what you saw last year from Schaller compared to this year. They look like two different players. He's healthy. He's motivated. He looks a lot closer to the guy we saw perform very well in Boston this year than the guy we saw last year in Vancouver. Doesn't have to be your favorite player, but if you don't think Tim Schaller, for the most part, has done his job for this hockey team this year, then I don't think you're paying attention properly. Remember, this isn't about higher-end skill. This isn't about who's the better player. Adam Gaudette's a better player. We all know that. Is Adam Gaudette a better player for that specific role? Well, if the role is be a fourth-line energy guy who hits more often and penalty kills, then Gaudette's not a better fit for that. Brock Besser's not a better fit for that. It's a different job resume that you need for that role. Yeah, Gaudette's the better hockey player. I don't want to see Gaudette come out of the lineup either. They can take out a different winger and still leave Tim Schaller in the lineup. I don't think he's coming out. Zach McEwen was rotating in today. Brandon Sutter was rotating in today. McEwen, I think, is an easy guy to sit in the press box, even though he got his first goal the other night. I think the coaching staff likes him, but the consistency isn't there right now. And then they have to make a decision as to whether or not Brandon Sutter is ready to play tomorrow. We'll continue to break that down on Canucks Central. Alex Auld will join us as well. And in this era of fantasy football and what you think you know about great quarterbacks, I've got a stat that's going to surprise you in advance of talking Seahawks-Rams with Mike Dugar next on the Scott Rintoul Show on your home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Sirlein missed it. Good snap, good hold. He just pushes it right ever so closely and just misses it.
Pete Carroll might have been born on the edge. He loves living there, man. He loves living there. He might have been born on the edge of the birthing table of the gurney wherever Pete Carroll was born. That's exactly where he might have been born. He probably balanced there perfectly and smiled about it, didn't cry whatsoever, embraced it. He loves living on the edge. Scott Rintoul with you. This is the Scott Rintoul Show on Sportsnet 650. Thanks for joining us for our final segment on a Friday. Canucks Central comes your way at the top of the hour. We're going to talk to Mike Dugar in just a couple of minutes about Pete Carroll, about those Seattle Seahawks who are 9-1 in games decided by one score. They've lived more dangerously than even previous campaigns would have indicated. I do want to talk about the Dallas Cowboys for a second, though, and about the bigger trend in the NFL as we head into Mike Dugar. So the Cowboys, they're no good. We know that. I will bounce off Mike Dugar. Playoff reform, you know this is part of my platform. I do not like the idea of inferior teams hosting playoff games. I don't think it's fair. Yes, you can get in. If we're going to keep divisional format, that's fine. Do I think that the probably 8-8 Dallas Cowboys should get to host the 12-4 or 13-3 Seahawks or Niners? No, I don't. I think it's garbage. Reward? You don't deserve one. You can argue whether they deserve to be in the playoffs or not. Divisional format, I will grant them that. You shouldn't get to host a game. But I digress. Dak Prescott leads this league in passing yards this year. If you're a fantasy football fan, you probably know that. If you're a Dak Prescott owner, you probably know that as well. He leads the league in passing yards. Maybe that's not a big surprise, even though they've got Ezekiel Elliott and even though they're supposed to be ground game first. Zeke had a couple of touchdowns last night at 81 yards. But Dak leads the league in passing yards. Here's what might surprise you in the era of air. It has never been easier to throw the football in the NFL. The rules are geared that way. Coaching strategy has changed. That's what teams do. They love to throw the football. Passing yards are king, right? How about this? The top six passers in the NFL, when we go by yardage, they have a combined record of 35-38. What? I'm sorry. Yeah, 35-38 for the top six yardage leaders in passing this year. Because yards, they don't mean a lot unless you punch touchdowns in. And when you go through the top five passers, the only reason that record is inflated whatsoever is by a guy who probably will surprise you is in the top five of passing yardage. Tom Brady, bringing in the 10-2 record of the Patriots, skews that close to 500. Yeah, Tom Brady's fifth in passing yardage. Phillip Rivers is third in passing yardage. Jameis Winston, second. These are the kind of guys we're talking about right now. The top six passers in the NFL have a combined record of 35-38. Do you want to know what the top six rushing teams are? Not top six rushers, but rushing teams. They're 53-19. Let that sink in for a second. The top six rushing teams in the NFL are 53-19, while the top six passers by yardage are three games under 500, and that's with Brady bumping that stock up significantly. And it all comes back to one thing. It all comes back to Peyton Manning. How does it come back to Peyton Manning? He's not even playing anymore. He racked up tons of passing yards. Yeah, he did. But after Peyton Manning put up those crazy numbers and the Colts offense scored all over the place and Peyton Manning hadn't won anything, you know what Peyton Manning realized? You're going to have to control the clock. Part of your defense is keeping the other offense off the field. And that's what a lot of teams, a lot of good ones around the National Football League do. They control the clock for minutes on end. They dominate quarters. They keep other teams on the sidelines. Remember how the Patriots beat the Chiefs? I know that game went to overtime, and it's great to have the ability to score fast, but you have to be good enough to grind out clock as well. The Patriots just held onto the ball for long, long portions of the AFC Championship game last year. And Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, they had the furious rally that got them to overtime and probably should have won that game. But the Patriots, they decided just to make things slow and to give you fewer possessions. And that's where we're at right now in the NFL. The passing yards are fun. They're more exciting to watch. The strategy of throwing the ball more, it has certainly crept into most successful head coaches' DNA. But you better be able to run the ball. You better be able to control the clock. Because if you don't, you're not going to do that well. Dak's yardage are pumped up. Those yards are pumped up because they're playing from behind a lot. They have been so bipolar in Dallas this year. When they play not very good teams, they look incredible. And they get people to believe. And they have scored more points right now than the Seahawks. Yeah, the Seahawks have played one less game. They'll play it this weekend. They'll be ahead of Dallas. The fact that it's even close, given a 6-7 Cowboys squad and a 10-2 Seahawks squad, tells you a lot about both teams. Dallas gets fat and happy when it wins. But it can't beat good teams. Seattle, they almost never get fat and happy. That's just not how they go. If they score a bunch of points, well, their opponent scores a bunch of points too. And one of the things I want to talk to Mike Dugar about as they get set for this Sunday nighter, it's another primetime game for Russell Wilson. He thrives in those environments. You all saw the numbers coming out on Monday night. He is the best quarterback ever as far as winning percentage goes on Monday Night Football for guys who have played a qualified number of games. He's 9-2 on Monday Night Football. I don't have his Sunday night stats in front of me, but they're excellent. His primetime stats are off the charts. Russell Wilson, even though he wasn't the star of the game on Thursday night, the running game for the Seahawks was, he's still throwing that long touchdown pass to David Moore. And even though he had the weird volleyball set instead of spike on the interception that got returned for a touchdown, Russell Wilson shows up. Russell Wilson makes plays. He runs at the right time. This is a dangerous game for the Seattle Seahawks. I know everybody says, they're the Rams. They're not as good. This is a dangerous game. They're due for a letdown at some point. It could come as soon as Sunday night. Tough to live on the margins they've been living on and keep throwing W's on the board. Just doesn't seem to work that way long term. Even the Ravens. The Ravens have won 8 straight games. And you probably don't think the Bills are that great. That's not an easy team to beat. Buffalo's not perfect, but they're tough. When you got a tough football team, you make things difficult for your opponent. You make teams grind things out. Now you got a chance. As said, I'm not calling this a trap game against the LA Rams, but this is a you can't look past a game for the Seattle Seahawks. No chance. Don't just chalk up a W right now, despite the way the trends have gone for these two teams this season. Mike Dugar of The Athletic, he'll join me. Maybe he agrees, maybe he disagrees. Mike, pleasure to have you on the show again. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing very well. I know you guys recently at The Athletic had a roundtable about the NFC West, and we all know where the cream of the crop has been. It's been the Seahawks. It's been the 49ers to this point. The Seahawks have lived on this thin margin all year, 9-1 in games decided by 8 points or less. Are they due for a letdown at some point here in the last quarter of the season, one of those letdown games where the margin doesn't quite fall their way?
Possibly. That's a good question. I mean, they always are, right? Like, you never really know. When you play that many one-possession games, and they play a bunch every year, it's not just this year. This year, the ball is just bouncing their way a little bit more than it did, say, in, like, 2017, where there were a few missed field goals away from, you know, a much better record, perhaps even going to the playoffs and winning 10 games. I would say so. I think the more important thing is just playing their type of football that they've been playing, because it will lend itself to the ball maybe bouncing their way a little bit more, you know, running the ball really well with two guys instead of all the burden on Chris, who's had some problems fumbling the ball, you know, getting that pass rush going, you know, much better secondary play, forcing the opponent into turnovers. That's what they need to do against Jared Goff. I mean, as much as you know, they've been lucky this year, they can create some of their own luck. When you get to the passer the way they have, when you stop the run the way they have. Like, I think they've been really lucky. We also have a piece on The Athletic about how lucky the Seahawks have been. That's by Ben Baldwin. But he also points out, man, it doesn't even really matter. You know, he just got to win. I'm sure the Dallas Cowboys would love to have the Seahawks luck right now. You know, even though they've scored more points and allowed fewer points, but they only have 6 wins. Like, winning is all that matters, really, at the end of the day.
Does this Rams defense look like one that the Seahawks should be able to run on come Sunday night?
Yeah, but not because the Rams are a bad defense. I think they looked bad against Lamar Jackson. But I think, as we've seen, you know, everyone looks bad against Lamar Jackson. I don't necessarily think that was indicative of how good or bad the Rams are as a defense. That's just, the defense has been really solid. It's actually been a lot more consistent than the offense. And I think you just look at the players they have on defense. You know, Weddle's a good player. Ramsey's a great player. Donald's a great player. You know, even Fowler, you know, linebacker. Clay Matthews, you know, they've got really good players on defense. Now, do I think the Seahawks will be able to run on them? Yeah. They always have been able to run the ball well, you know, on the Rams. And I think that you'll see over the course of these last 4 games, a lot of teams doing what the Vikings did on Monday night is, you know, playing a lot of cover 2 shells, you know, to protect the deep ball, because you don't want Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf to just torch you. Well, what does that do? That opens it up for, you know, Chris Carson and Rashad Penny to get going. And when the Seahawks have 2 running backs going like that, then they're super duper hard to stop, as Minnesota learned on Monday night.
Yeah, they certainly are. Mike Dugar of The Athletic joining me here on Sportsnet 650. You make a very good point. Do the Rams look like a team to you because of what you mentioned about Jalen Ramsey? Do they look like a team to you that has to go too deep, or can they lock things down a little bit differently than some of the other the opponents that Seattle's faced recently?
That's a great question. I wish I could ask Wade Phillips that to see how he'd respond. My guess is that they will have to kind of mimic some of what the Vikings did. But, you know, maybe Wade thinks they'll win up front in a way that the Vikings did not. You know, DK Metcalf's just too good. You have to put someone over there. I think he has like 700 yards or something like that. You have to put another guy over there because as he's shown all year, he wins one-on-one matchups, which is really, really important. You know, he wins on those slants. He wins on the little comebacks. He could definitely burn you deep. And they have a lot of guys who just torch man coverage. So if you want to get super aggressive like the Buccaneers did, who got lit up, maybe like the Steelers did, who got lit up, you can try those type of things. And maybe the Rams will because, you know, Wade's that type of dude. But at the end of the day, you got to protect over the top. And if you're not, you know, playing safe at some point through it all the time, Russ and those guys will kill you. I mean, David Moore had a 60-yard touchdown, you know, like it's going to happen. So I would, if I was Wade, I would probably mix it in a little bit, but for the most part, I'd be playing it safe because at the end of the day, Russ is a MVP caliber cat right now.
He most certainly is. And if it weren't for Lamar Jackson, he's probably winning the MVP award. Still a lot to be determined, a month to go. Russell Wilson could surge ahead. We'll wait and see. On the other side of the ball, I can't figure out the Seattle pass rush. It's fits and starts. What do you make of it so far?
I think we're going to learn a lot about it in the next couple weeks because, you know, 1 week it was Jadeveon Clowney, right? He lit the world on fire, you know, against the Niners. I think that was week 10. And then the very next week he didn't play, or the next game rather, he didn't play. And then Ziggy Ansah and Rasheem Green just kind of just tore it up, tore up the Eagles, who were, you know, banged up on the O-line. And then on Monday night, JD didn't really do a bunch. And then what do you know, Ziggy had one of his better games. But now Ziggy's banged up. Clowney's now still dealing with that hip injury or core, whatever they want to call it, something he's probably going to need surgery on the minute the year is over. So it's a little bit hit and miss right now. It kind of depends on how much percentage we're getting from JD, Jadeveon Clowney. If he's at like 50, then that's not really great for the Seahawks. They need him probably around like 75 in terms of his health and the effort he can give, because what that does is just makes everyone else just play a lot better. You know, Rasheem Green's been playing great as of late. They've added Shaquem Griffin into the mix. Quentin Jefferson is still, you know, one of their best pass rushers, in my opinion. So if they can get to Goff, which should be goal number one, like forget what the secondary is able to do for a minute. Goal number one should be to beat up Goff the way they beat up Jimmy G and Carson Wentz, because as they'll learn again, like they did with Kirk Cousins on Monday, if you don't get to him, he can beat you, man. He can throw it deep. I don't think Kirk's very good, but he is one of those guys that if you just stand there and let him throw, he will torch you. And Jared Goff is definitely in that category as well.
The NFC has a conference far deeper than the AFC this year, and there's a lot of parity at the top. Is there a team to beat in the NFC, or are there just multiple teams that can make the exact same claim?
I think it's been that way, that there's been multiple teams for years. If you look at the NFC representatives in the Super Bowl over the last, like, I don't know, 15 years, has anyone even gone back-to-back? You know, I think obviously the Seahawks did. But, you know, aside from that, like, no one has, man. It's hard to get to the Super Bowl in the NFC because you got to, you know, go through a slugfest of good teams, and anyone can be good on any given year. You know, look at the Eagles just randomly got hot. Falcons randomly got hot in 2016. Panthers randomly got hot in 2015. You know, it's so tough, and this year is no different. You look at the Seahawks, they've always had another good team in the division this whole Pete Carroll run. Always, whether it's the Cardinals, whether it's been the Niners, now it's the Niners again. Last few years it's been the Rams. You know, it's like this every year, and Seattle's been able to be one of those teams that's always in the conversation. And so I expect them to be, you know, in the conversation this year. But yeah, there's no favorite here. I know there's a debate going on locally about who the Seahawks should be rooting for this weekend, the Niners or the Saints. You know, rooting for the Niners is kind of rooting for the chance to get the number one seed. Rooting for the Saints is kind of just like, hey, we just want to buy, you know, maybe get the number two seed, and whatever happens. You should be rooting for that number, you know, root for the Saints. You know, win the division first, because the division is not a given. You know, like the Seahawks, if they get a bye, who knows what happens if they're the number two seed. They could end up, you know, being having home field throughout if the Saints slip, which they easily could because there's so much parity, like you mentioned.
Well, here's what I do know. If you finish second in the West, you get completely screwed over by the playoff format. Can we start stumping for, okay, you win your division, you're in, but you don't necessarily get to host if you've got a terrible team that's going to host a team with 12 or 13 wins in the postseason?
I'm a little mixed up overreacting to what's going to be, you know, it's more often than not, the division winner is going to be a, you know, a formidable opponent in the first weekend. Like, it's going to be rare you get these, like, the Seahawks were like the last really bad team to host the playoff game, right? That's 2010, the Beastquake game. And what did that give us? You know, one of the best runs in probably postseason history. So I'm not super in a rush to overcorrect. I think that, yeah, more often than not, you're going to get a decent division winner from all four teams. I don't think we need to just scrap that. Will it be unfortunate in some years? Yeah, it will. But at the same time, yes. The loser of the NFC West will probably get, what, 13-3, but have to go to 7-9 Dallas. Well, I mean, hey, go beat 7-9 Dallas. You know, if you're a team that won 13 games, at the end of the day, the Saints should have came in here and won in 2010. They didn't. That sucks. Be better next year. I understand why people are frustrated. They see, like, a 7-9 Dallas team or an 8-8 Philly team is going to host a playoff game, which, you know, drastically increases your chances of going to the Super Bowl. But as Jerry Jones kind of hinted at last night, not hinted at, he stated several times, if they don't start winning football games, then it doesn't matter whether you get into the playoffs or not. If you stink, you stink, right? And if you're a 7-9 hosting a 13-3 Niners team or a 13-3 Seahawks team, your home field won't matter. You'll get blown out, especially if you're losing to Mitch Trubisky and the Bears. So I get why people are frustrated, but I wouldn't be in a rush to kind of overcorrect that rule. I think it's just fine how it is.
Mike Dugar gets to plan his best case scenario, the game you want to watch the most in the NFC Championship today. Which two teams do you want to see duke it out for NFC supremacy?
Oh man, that's tough because I have my own selfish interests, right? Like I'm not really a Seahawks fan because, you know, can't be, job title and all that. However, I would selfishly love to cover the Super Bowl, so I'm inclined to set up the matchup that, you know, favors that outcome, which would be anything but the 49ers. Because those guys are super good. So I think what I would go with in that regard is probably a rematch of Saints Seahawks. Even if that's in New Orleans, I think they still have Seahawks have a good shot. Undefeated on the road this year. That's probably what I would go with in that regard. But what would be the best game would easily be Seahawks 49ers. Like it would have the most drama attached to it. I mean, think about that. Richard Sherman back here in Seattle with the Niners after the tip that basically destroyed the Niners franchise and set them back all those years. Oh, that would just be just unbelievably good. Not to mention the similar styles of the two teams who just love to run it down your throat with multiple backs, with great pass rush, play good defense, force turnovers. I mean, you see how great that Monday night game was, you know, a month ago. Let's just run that back. Like, that would probably produce the best game. Whereas maybe the best chance of going to the Super Bowl for the Seahawks is avoiding the 49ers altogether.
Yeah, and we'll see if that final game of the regular season is for the division title. That would be great as well. I know fans in Seattle don't want that right now. They want that to be out of the question and have the Niners lose, and it's already wrapped up. But, man, if we could have Seahawks 49ers three times, three meaningful games, hook it to my veins. But I see you working. I see you working for a trip to the Big Easy. I see you working for a trip to Miami. I got you. I feel that.
Yeah, man, come on. I've never been to New Orleans. I just went to Miami for the first time in August, and it was fantastic. So, you know, I'd love to go down there and, you know, gain 10 pounds eating a bunch of Southern food, and then I'd love to go, you know, to South Beach for a week. So, yeah, man, these are selfish rooting interests that I'm not afraid to highlight because I'll still write the story, you know, fairly or whatever. But, I mean, if you're asking me, you know, best case is what's best for me, not necessarily the Seahawks. So that's why I had to frame it that way.
Well, if that best case scenario for you plays out, either or both of those places, we're calling you, you're coming on the show, and we're having that conversation again, okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, anytime.
Thanks, Mike. I'm the same way. Seahawks 49ers, if I can sign up for that NFC Championship game right now, that's what I want to see. And each team is very fearful of the other. So I understand the trepidation, but if I just want the best football, I'm with Mike. With all due respect to the Saints, who I know people have claimed is the best team in the NFC, unless I see something more explosive from that offense over the course of the next 4 weeks, I can't go there. I know the potential's there. I'm not going to say they're Dallas, where I also know the potential exists for them to be explosive. I'm not claiming New Orleans is that. They're obviously better than that, and they've obviously got a better defense than that. But just hasn't gone on all cylinders this year, has it? Michael Thomas has been incredible. The fact that people are even talking about him in the MVP conversation is out of this world. He's not going to win it, but the fact that somebody wants to make sure he's in that discussion tells you how good he's been, and that's been across two different quarterbacks. But they haven't been able to get Kamara going. The secondary receiving has been sometimes there, other times not. I need to see more explosion from New Orleans if I'm going to label them in that category. I know the record puts them there, but their division is also trash. They're the only team over 500 in their division. It's all fallen apart. That's why they've clinched a playoff berth already. That's why they've already won the division through 12 games of this season. Good weekend of football on tap. Sunday nighter, Seahawks, Rams. You've got the 49ers, Saints. You've got the Pats and the Chiefs. You've got the Ravens and the Bills. Those are the four marquee games of the weekend. Your weekend gets going before that with the Vancouver Canucks, however. We'll get into what they're doing with their lines right now. Alex Auld will join us. The final Canucks Central of the Week goes next right here on your home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.